South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right. Well, a very good Saturday morning, and gosh, nice to be back here to answer questions. They kind of just shut down the radio station last weekend, so all the engineers and everybody could have a little bit of an extended Thanksgiving holiday, but I am back here live and local with you, as we like to say. Looks like John and Shirley are going to be my next two callers, but that leaves a couple of open lines. You know, the number 210-599-5555. Gosh, lots of things to talk about. It's going to be a warm day today. You're going to be back up in the 70s. Going to feel little bit more like early fall than it is like December, but golly, it's going to be a beautiful day to get out and about. I don't know if you've been out looking at plants, but the poinsettias this year, the Christmas cactus this year, are absolutely spectacular, along with the cyclamen and pansies and things for your yard. Anyway, so many different things to talk about, but what is most important is what is on your mind. So, Jimmy, let's just get started with phone calls, and John is first in line. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob.
Morning, sir.
I've been accumulating some questions, so I'm going to run through the list.
All right. You picked the right time to call. We've got 30 minutes here before I have to do a break.
Of course, Shirley may be waiting for a while. But I told you a while back that I bought, or didn't buy, a friend was using the racks of some those 360-gallon water containers.
Right.
He was using them for something and had the empties or the plastic left. And so I'm going to make a raised bed with these, going to put aluminum, corrugated aluminum around the side of them to support them and T-posts on that.
Do you mean aluminum or do you mean galvanized metal?
No, I'm sorry, galvanized
okay.
metal.
Okay, yeah, big difference.
yeah. Anyway. That will just be my structural support for these, so they hold up a little better. But I just wanted these for the bed itself. But I'm getting ready to over the holiday to buy the soil and put them in it, and didn't know if I should in another raised bed. I put a bunch of garbage in the bottom, stumps and stuff, and talked to you after the fact. And of course, wasn't a great idea. My question. Do I just completely fill it with garden mix or do something different in the bottom foot? Or I do have probably 100 gallons worth of 5-gallon buckets of river rock that I've pulled out of my garden over the last 20 years.
Absolutely.
And I've never figured out what to do with it. So I could put that in the bottom just to take up 2 or 3 inches in all of those containers. But is there any good in doing that other than saving a few bucks on dirt?
No.
Okay.
No.
The
more dirt you have, the more roots you have. The more roots you have, the better the plants you have. So, I mean, if you wanted to put half an inch. Have you drilled a bunch of holes in the bottom?
I have. Yeah,
of the plastic containers?
I've gone ahead and drilled the holes so they're not holding water sitting out there.
Yeah, if you want to put just a very thin layer of gravel on the bottom just to keep the soil from washing out, that's fine. But, you know, no more than an inch or so of material like that. And beyond that, like I say, the better the soil, the better the roots, and that's what it's all about. Now, the galvanized metal that you're going to use, is that going to be outside the plastic liner, or is that going to be inside the plastic liner?
No, it'll be outside. It'll be
good.
Basically
good.
Structural support for the plastic, just so it can't collapse outside.
That's perfect, because zinc, which is what they use to galvanize the material with, is very hard on plant roots. It'll burn every root that touches it. So I'm glad the soil is going to be, you know, separated from your galvanizing.
Right.
But it sounds to me like you've got the perfect raised bed.
Okay, good. Now, do I add fertilizer? Like if I get a foot of soil, do I add fertilizer and then put another foot in, or just fertilize from the top?
That's strictly up to you. If you could blend it into the soil as you go, like you're describing, that would be the absolute ultimate way to do it. If it's not convenient, you know, you're 99% of the people are just going to put the fertilizer on the surface. But it would certainly, using a dry, granular, slow-release organic fertilizer like Medina or Nature's Creation, Maestro, whatever you're using, that would be a great thing to do and will give you wonderful results. That would be the way to go. But if for whatever reason that becomes inconvenient, not absolutely necessary. Now, are you going to have multiple containers, or is this how many of these raised beds are you planning?
Well, I'm going to connect three in a row and do so. I have six half containers. I've already cut them in half and drilled holes in the bottom. So six halves. And I've got to go out today and measure those to see exactly how many cubic feet of dirt I need, but my other raised bed is shrunk down a foot anyway, so I need to fill it back up anyway. So
and that's the reason I was asking is that with that much space, it would behoove you cost wise. If you have a truck or a trailer, just go pick it up, because you're probably going to need a cubic yard or so. And you know, the delivery charge will run as much as the soil does, but compared to the cost of buying it a bag at a time, the bag soil is a little better. But when you consider the cost, it's a lot more expensive. It costs a lot to put soil in a bag and seal it up and ship it somewhere. So I'd go out to SiteOne or somewhere and just tell them you want a good garden mix. If you want to buy a little better quality compost and blend that in as you go, that probably would be at least as important as the fertilizer.
Okay, that raises another question. I heard you and the dirt doctor, gee, I can't think of his name right now. I think it was Cal Thomas.
Well, and his license plate, he was by here last week, and his license plate is Dirt, D-U-R-T. So dirt doctor is just fine. His name's Howard Garrett, but everybody knows
Howard,
him as
well,
the dirt doctor.
I couldn't think of that for anything. I heard y'all talking a while back about things not really decomposing after, you know, they need oxygen to decompose. So having any mulch or anything that needs to break down still more than a foot deep is fairly ineffective. Is that true or not true?
Well, you know, the more oxygen you have in the soil, the better. But good organic soil is going to have lots of oxygen in it. The microbes in the soil build, think of it as a honeycomb structure. I mean, it's not that big, it's not that obvious, but if you could imagine your container filled with a more microscopic honeycomb that's holding the clay particles, is holding the bigger particles apart in an organized grid, you're going to get lots of oxygen, you're going to get lots of water holding capacity. But that's sort of the price you pay for putting it in a container. But the quality of the soil and the way you take care of it to maintain the microbial life, that's going to maintain the consistency of the soil, which is going to allow plenty of oxygen. Because, you know, think about, I don't know where you live, but if you've got deep soil, I'll take one of my pastures, which is down along a creek bed where I've got huge pecan trees. You know, those trees have roots 10 feet, 20 feet deep down in the soil, and obviously there's plenty of oxygen there for them, so I'm not going to be concerned about that. Do your best to use pretty well decomposed material when you put things in, but the only thing you're going to miss out on is, you know, it's going to steal a little bit of fertilizer and things like that, the microbes are, but I think you're going to have plenty of oxygen in there if you use a good quality soil.
Okay, so I every fall I gather everybody's leaves in the neighborhood and mow them up and put them in bags and then spread them around. Excuse me, spread them around. Golly, spread them around in the garden. And so I have several bags left. It's just to fluff that soil up, even though I'm going to plant it probably as soon as at least broccoli and cauliflower and stuff like that. As soon as I get the beds done, would putting that leafy material that's not broken down be any benefit, or just
only on the surface?
Mulch on
it'll
top.
Be okay. Yeah, just the greatest of mulch on top, but not blended in.
Okay, good. All right, that was my plan. Now, second question that discussions I've heard you have brought up, You've said in the past that spraying like has to grow on my tomato plants and that kind of thing. Does gives you quick growth up top, but doesn't strengthen the plant as much as having as watering the fertilizer in down in just the soil. So raise the question for me is, I guess what they call side dressing, just every month or so coming in with granular fertilizer and putting it around the drip, you know, around the whole base of the plant, basically. Is that as effective as a liquid? I know it's not as fast, but
right.
Is it,
yeah.
If it's, you're doing it continuously, does that keep you a constant fertilizer?
It does, but you'd only have to do it like every 3 months. Because if you're getting a good quality organic fertilizer, it's going to continue to feed for at least 90 days. So it would be extra work and unnecessary to do it on a monthly basis. I still like using the liquids because they are more available to the plants. I tend to use granular fertilizer when I plant and then just follow it up with liquid fertilizer as I'm able. But nothing wrong with side dressing, but it's going to be a little bit longer, you know, when you first put it on to start feeding the plants. But a good application is to feed for 90 days, so you don't have to keep running back out there to do it over and over. I do believe in periodically foliar feeding. I think it's a good thing to do. But a friend with USDA many years ago made the comment in a lecture I was attending that a plant only grows as many roots as it needs to support itself. And if you're giving the plant everything it needs through its leaves, it has no incentive to develop a good root system. So nothing wrong with foliar feeding, but don't make it your only source of nutrition.
Okay. Well, my typical routine is to mix dirt in the soil. I dig a bigger hole than I need for my tomato plants, typically.
Sure.
And dig an ugly hole, put granular in that, water it in with Has to Grow, and then use Has to Grow through the season. But I thought, well, you know, if I just drop a granular fertilizer out there every 3 months now, but just for my tomato plants and that kind of thing, it seemed like that would be just as effective. And then I wouldn't. I've also talked to you about pressure compensated water
mm-hmm.
system yep. that I've wanted to use a liquid fertilizer in that.
Sure.
And have never done anything with it. But and that's my next question. But I thought if I can just use granular, then I don't need to worry about trying to figure a system to mix fertilizer in with my water as I use that pressure compensated hose. But,
well, it just, you know, you're going to get a greater diversity of nutrients in a wider range of forms if you, you know, it's kind of like saying, well, I'm, you know, hamburger's all I need to live on, but do I want to eat hamburger for my meal 3 times a day for, you know, as the only thing I have? So you'll survive on it, but are you going to thrive on it is always the question.
Right.
And I want to see your garden thriving, not just getting by.
Okay, so the Has to Grow liquid has other material in it besides what?
Oh, yeah. And I like almost as well as Has to Grow plant, I like Medina's what they call their liquid fish blend. And in my gardens and greenhouse, I alternate the two of those. I'll use a Has to Grow plant one time and liquid fish blend the next time, and the results have been just outstanding.
Okay. I'm writing this down. all right. So on my pressure compensated hose, I've
uh-huh.
still not gotten this the way I like it. I need to figure out basic watering on these things. If I have a row of tomatoes, say I've got 6 plants in a row, and I want to use pressure compensated hose, do I circle the plant or just run it down one side and then back up the other? Or
that's what I do, down one side and back the other. That's all you need. And you're just going to have to experiment as to how often you're going to run that system. The one thing I will tell you about injecting fertilizer into the water through your pressure compensated tubing, you're going to have to buy a more expensive injector, is what you would call it, to put, you know, the fertilizer into the water. because the cheap and easy way to do it is something called the siphon mixer that you just hook on the hydrant, hook the hose onto it, and it has little hose that hangs down into a bucket. But when you put the back pressure into the hose that you're going to get from the pressure-compensated tubing, the siphoner is going to stop working. You can't use a super long hose.
You tell me where to get that, or who to call. Some irrigation company, and I immediately forgot it before the conversation was over, so I need to write that down.
S.A. is in San Antonio, S.A. Rainmaker.
Rainmaker.
Yeah, talk to Bill over there. Tell him we talked.
Okay. All right. So that was kind of my question. Each emitter or each hole in the hose, I think there are different types, but I think mine are 9 gallons per hour. Is that typical?
9 gallons per minute. I'm sorry. No, you're right. No, it is 9 gallons per hour. That's right.
9 gallons an hour. So if I'm watering a tomato plant and I have emitters, running on each side of it, how many gallons roughly if it's dry, the soil's gotten fairly dry and I know I'll have to figure out.
I usually run the system for an hour and a half at a time. If I get it set on a controller, which I do when I'm out of town, it runs for an hour per zone.
Okay. All right. And final question. Once I put that hose down, do I put my leaf mulch over that or do I put it on top of the leaf mulch and leave it exposed to the sun?
I would put the leaves over it. My experience is the tubing itself lasts for years, but the L's and T's and things that you put it together with become brittle in the sunlight over time. So at least cover up your connectors. Other than that, it's up to you. A lot of people like to leave the tubes exposed just so that you can see it's working, see that wet spot around each emitter, but that's not mandatory.
Okay. All right, good. That's all my questions, Bob. I appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure, and look forward to talking again. Good luck on the project, and keep me posted on how you're doing, and feel free to call anytime, John. It's always good to hear from you. And, Jimmy, let's move on to Shirley. Good morning, Shirley.
Good morning, Bob. I have a question about, I have a bay window. I need an evergreen bush, a couple of them. I'd like them not to get more than 5 feet tall. What would you recommend? They have some direct sun and then rest filtered sun.
Okay, and this is, you want to plant these shrubs outside the bay window, correct?
Yes.
Okay. There are several choices. One good choice would be something called dwarf Burford holly. They call it dwarf because the standard gets 15 feet tall. The dwarf gets about 4 to 6 feet, so that's right in your size range. And it would be a very good choice for you. Compact Nandina is a great plant. It grows to about 5 feet. It produces, in the cool months, the leaves become very brightly colored. They'll be, the more sun they get, the more colorful they get. But the leaves turn a brilliant color in the fall, and then they turn green again in the spring. They don't fall off, but they maintain some nice color, throughout the winter season. And, those would do very well in a place like that for you. Other things going to stay down to a 5 foot or lower height. There's a new variety of boxwood called Baby Jim, G-E-M. And it actually grows to about 3.5 feet in height and doesn't get just big and overgrown like the old Japanese boxwood. And it is more tolerant of shade than the others, than the other boxwoods are. So Baby Jim boxwood would be another good one that's going to stay a little bit more on the compact side. The direct sun that this bay window gets, is it morning or afternoon when it gets the sun?
It's probably right in the middle of the day.
Okay. I was going to suggest a Cuba, but that's probably going to be too much sun for a Cuba. But those are all evergreen shrubs. Things you might want to consider planting along with them. Plumbago is going to give you flowers about 9 months out of the year, either the blue or white form. Could be planted, and it's going to grow up about 3 feet tall, and it'll be beautiful in combination with those. There are several salvias that are shade tolerant, some of them are evergreen, some of them freeze down and then come back out again. that would complement the evergreen, you know, nature of the shrubs very widely. Sure. You can turn this into a beautiful bed. But most probably my top three choices are going to be the dwarf Burford, the compact Nandina, and the baby chum boxwater are the first three that come to mind.
I think I've had dwarf Burford before. Is it kind of slow growing, or and of course I'm an impatient gardener. Let's put it that way.
Well, in the shade, you're going to have to develop a little patience, or you're going to have to plant bigger plants. anything in the shade is going to be a little slower growing. You fertilize and take care of them, they're going to grow, but, I mean, this is not Japanese ligustrum that's going to grow 3 feet a month practically. But all of them are going to be moderate in their growth rate. They're not super slow, but, again, if you were to plant one-gallon plants, it's going to take a couple of years for them to really fill in. If you plant five-gallon plants, they're going to be well-established in a year. If you plant 15-gallon plants, they're going to be beautiful the day you plant them. It just depends on how big a hole you want to plant and how much you want to pay for them.
Okay. Sounds great. And I have another question. I have a nephew that is in North Dakota. That's where my husband was from. 3 miles from the Canadian border on that Red River dirt of the north. It's beautiful, dark dirt. Mm-hmm. He is an organic gardener, but he can't find organic stuff to put on. He had problems with worms last year. His aunt is driving up there for the Christmas, and she's going to bring him some stuff from here to put on his garden. Now, if you had three things to put on a garden to keep the bugs and worms and stuff away, what would they be?
One would be what we call BT, stands for Bacillus thuringiensis. It has a shelf life of about 30 years, so it's going to last for quite a long time. Okay. The second thing for general insect problems is going to be called Spinosad, S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D, Spinosad soap. And it has a shelf life of several years, and these are all non-toxic to people and pets. But yeah. Spinosad soap would be my next choice. And my third product would probably be a dry material, which is called Sluggo, S-L-U-G-G-O, Sluggo Plus.
Okay, I have all those. Okay.
Yeah, they're all three good. Sluggo's going to take care of snail slugs and pill bugs. The BT is going to take care of all the caterpillars that might be causing an issue there. And the Spinosad soap is going to take care of everything else.
And that Spinosad soap comes in a concentrate too, doesn't it?
Yeah, they all come as a concentrate, as a ready-to-use, or probably as a ready-to-spray that you just put on the end of the hose. But most economical, of course, is as a concentrate.
Okay, all right. I'll get those from you all and send them up to him.
Well, you might include a couple of gallons of Has to Grow if you want to send him some good liquid organic fertilizer. And you might ask him if he can find this product called Azomite, A-Z-O-M-I-T-E, if he can find Azomite up there, because that that's just one of the very best products he's going to be able to use for micronutrients and things like that.
I don't think I have any of that. You have that, I guess. What is it for exactly?
I tell people, think of it as green sand on steroids. Anytime you're trying to get things to green up a little bit better, or things just aren't thriving, Azomite brings in more different micronutrients in one package, so to speak, than anything I've ever seen. It's got iron, it's got manganese, it's got zinc, it's got sulfur, it's got cobalt, iodine, all the things that the plants need in very small quantities, but it's a dry, non-staining material, and you get it almost as a powder. I get it as a granule, and then I just sling it around by hand. It does not burn. It's just, I don't know, it's something that we've been using for 2-3 years now, and just extremely pleased with it.
Okay, I'm going to get some of that for myself when I come down there next time.
Well, it's a wonderful material. I'll just put it that way.
Okay. Well, goodness gracious. Are you open 7 days a week, Bob? I forget.
We close 7 days a year. Yes, we're open 7 days a year, 7 days a week. Next time we'll be closed, we close for Christmas and New Year's. But in fact, we close about noon on Christmas Eve and about noon on New Year's Eve. But no, we're here 7 days a week. It's 9 to 4 Monday through Saturday and 10 till 4 on Sundays.
Okay, I've been there so much I should know. But anyway, okay, Bob, is it time to plant onions?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. All right. I'll see you soon. Take care.
We'll look forward to it, Shirley. Thank you for the call and the good questions this morning. I appreciate it.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Goodbye. All right. Got some open lines. Grab one at 210-599-5555. We're just about 10 seconds away from news here. So get your line and I'll get your questions answered. Clint, sorry you couldn't hold on. Hopefully you can call back in a minute or two. You're listening to Gardening on KTSA Radio in beautiful San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening on a very nice Saturday morning out there. Chilly this morning, 42 when I left home. It make you pick up that light jacket, but it's going to be a beautiful day today. It looks like, if the weathermen get it right, it's going to be sunny and temperatures up in the low 70s. Isn't that just what fall weather ought to be? Anyway, love the kind of weather we're having for at least the next week or so. We're going to talk to Faye and Julie and Kathleen. Faye is first in line. Good morning, Faye.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's 63 down here.
Well, you're a little warmer, but better that than 33 or 23 or whatever else. So, yeah, you can just go out and go to work. You don't have to put on long sleeves and things like I did this morning.
Well, you know, it's kind of nice in some ways. We've had a lot of rain lately, so we're catching up on the moisture, and I think it should be a good rest of the year, probably.
Well, it's looking better weather water-wise. We need a lot more rain in our part of the world. But the other thing that I love is this gradual cool down, because I think everybody's had a few mornings, at least in the 40s, in the hill country, certainly down in the 30s, and that's what hardens the plants off. So many plants, even normally hardy plants, get damaged when it's 90 degrees one day and 25 degrees the next. But this gradual cool down that we've experienced this fall has been just exactly what we wanted to help the plants slowly harden off and get ready for colder weather.
It's been a really interesting year for plants. We have
an understatement.
I think we were 100 degrees 2 months here, roughly. That's pretty close. Mm-hmm. And acre of property that's just makes grasses and so forth, it looked really dead. And now you'd never know that it.
Nature has a wonderful way of restoring herself, and we're seeing the same. There is some dead grass around, but most of the native grasses looking out there now, you'd never know we've been in a drought. So. Wasn't any fun while it was here, but the land is recovering.
It's really quite an interesting, it's been quite an interesting thing to, hard in many ways, but still, science-wise, really interesting, I think.
That's an understatement, but I totally agree.
I have a, you were talking about coffee grounds and the change in view about coffee. Should we go ahead using our grounds into our soil, or would you just sprinkle them farther away? That was something I wanted to ask you about.
I would just, all things in moderation. They are not toxic in any way, but they seem to stunt the growth of things. You know, it's funny, growing up, our parents, or at least mine, always told me, don't drink too much coffee, it'll stunt your growth. And apparently, I don't know whether it did anything to us kids or not, because I really enjoyed that. I'm sure it was mostly milk and not much coffee, but that feeling like I was a big kid and got to have coffee with my grandparents was wonderful. But I would just use it in moderation. There's no doubt that the earthworms like it very much, and If it has a mild stunning effect, well, who cares if your tomato plant is only 6 feet tall instead of 10 feet tall? So I still plan to use coffee grounds, but I'm not going to be just heaping mounds and mounds of them on the soil like I have in the past. I can't say that I've ever really observed any stunning effect, but maybe I just wasn't watching closely enough.
Well, we'll just continue, but maybe spread them a little farther then.
I think that would be, it's kind of like ashes. Too much ash is not a good thing, but a moderate amount of ash adds a lot of micronutrients. So all things in moderation. I think that applies to a lot of life.
Yes, and I have another vegetable question.
Yeah.
What do I plant from seed now?
Now remember, whatever you plant, it takes a little while for it to become cold hardy. The day it sprouts up out of the ground, it doesn't have any antifreeze in it. It's the effect of the sunlight hitting the leaves, building sugars. That's what builds the cold resistance in plants. So anything you plant from seed, if it gets real cold before the plants have had, once they've sprouted, but if they haven't had a couple of weeks to harden off, as the saying goes, then you'll need to cover them. But things that are certainly good to plant now include spinach, pretty much all your leafy things, spinach and chard, kale, lettuce, bok choy, all those things can certainly be planted from seed. All of your root crops can be planted from seed, like radishes and beets and carrots and turnips, and those can certainly go in. Not from seed, but it's certainly time to be planting onions. Those you'll set out as plants, but it's basically going to be the leafy greens and the root crops. Plus, one other thing that I think would be a good thing to plant is going to be your edible pod peas, what people, you know, kind of lump together and call snow peas. There are lots of different varieties out there. My favorite right now happens to be one called Oregon Sugar Pod. But those can certainly be planted from seed. But just remember, all the things coming up from seed, it's going to take two, three, 4 weeks for them to really get their antifreeze levels up. So if the weather turns around and it looks like it's going to get down to frost, you'll need to cover them for a little while.
And the other thing is, I have some pasture, fall pasture grass seeds still.
Yeah.
Will those go to midsummer if I get them up now?
Depends on what they are. Most of them will, if they're cool weather things like, you know, oats or wheats or rye or any of those. Yeah, they'll last until it gets either really hot or really dry. They'll continue to grow and give you good forage out there.
Well, thank you. That was a good long list, but it was very compact. So thank you for the help here, Bob.
You're certainly welcome, Faye. You get out and enjoy this this beautiful stretch of weather we're having, and I know I'll hear from you again soon. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay, certainly. Goodbye. All right. Believe my let me see right here. Look real quickly. This looks like my next caller is going to be Julie. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have a question about poinsettias. I got quite a few. They are beautiful this year.
Oh, are they not spectacular? And some of the new varieties, this one called Glitter, it looks like, you know, we used to call it Jingle Bells, but boy, this is just an enhanced form of them. There are a lot of pretty poinsettias. And I don't know if you've looked at Christmas cactus. I don't think I've ever seen Christmas cacti prettier than they are this year. So it's a
well,
good season for those midwinter flowers.
I know, and they're beautiful. But what I wanted to ask is, can you give kind of a tutelage on how to take care of them? And inside, last year, and I'm a good plant person, and I had not good luck with them. And I think because it was so cold,
yeah,
and the heater was up. But I have humidifiers going and everything. But can you give me the do this but don't do that?
Okay, do this. Give them lots and lots of light. If they're inside, they need to spend the majority of their time in front of a good sunny window, not just bright, but a good sunny window, because they really like lots of light. They want to be watered thoroughly whenever the soil is dry on the surface. Don't really have to be fed, but if you want to feed them once a month or so, I mean, poinsettias ought to last till Easter, if you
Absolutely.
Get a good, Yeah, if you get a good fresh one. Probably the single most important thing is that they hate drafts. You do not want cold air or warm air blowing directly on them. So be sure that heater vent, you know, is not pointing directly at the plants, and don't put them right next to a door that gets open frequently and a, you know, blast of cold air rushes in and hits them. But, and the other thing, of course, is to be sure that you're getting good fresh flowers. You can tell how ripe, so to speak, is what the florists sometimes say, or how mature, by looking right in the center. Those brightly colored things are not leaves, they're bracts, they're not petals or anything, but the actual flower is that little round thing that comes out in the middle, kind of looks half open and has some yellow to it as it gets further along.
Okay, I'm looking at them now.
Yeah, it should look like fairly tight buds. You shouldn't be seeing a lot of yellow down to those things. And if those buds have opened to the point where they almost look fuzzy, all the stamen sticking out, those flowers are getting a little old, and eventually those are the reproductive parts of the flower, those all just fall off. So when you're buying poinsettias, the freshest, most long-lasting poinsettia is going to be where those little things right in the center are still just little green balls, or maybe just starting to open. So,
red ones, they look like they're about to start to come up open, but the white ones are still pretty tight. So.
Yeah, well, those are both, those are fresh. It's when they get open and fuzzy and start to fall out that you don't want to be buying those. plants are beyond their prime.
These are very nice.
Yeah, but plenty of light. Plenty of light and no drafts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I figured last year, because I think I had some too close to a heating vent. And I mean, they expired in 2 weeks when I was so mad at myself. I kind of knew that. Okay. Well, the other thing, sometimes the red leaf looks a little bit wilty, but then you test the water and it isn't. Not water, but the soil.
Yeah.
And it's not, doesn't seem to be dry. What does that mean anything, or is it just the character of the flower?
Sometimes it may be just character of the flowers, but sometimes it means they're being kept too wet. Now, if they're getting adequate light, this is what draws the water through the plant. So you want to wait until the pot's good and dry on the surface. But there are many varieties, too, I don't know all of the new ones. But some of them are a little bit more sensitive to doing that if the soil gets waterlogged. So be sure you water thoroughly when you water, but be sure you allow it to dry to the proper point before you water again.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And you have a great month.
Well, you Merry and yours Christmas. Do, and you and yours do the same. Thank you so much, and I appreciate the call. Kathleen, hold on just a minute. We need to get a break in here, and I get to talk to you about Green Grow Organics. And once again, I'm hearing stories about people telling me horror stories about some of these chemical companies that came out and accidentally sprayed all their poison and synthetic fertilizers on the wrong lawn. It's just, don't trust those guys. They're using products you can't trust, things that could be deadly to your pets, things that are not good for people. You know, if you want somebody that you can rely on to come by on a quarterly basis and use only organic products, well, think about Green Grow Organics and Sam Sitterly. This is a new service he's offering. He's always been there to help you with the fertilizing and consultation and everything you need. But he knows everybody's busy and knows that you just really don't want to have to remember to fertilize every 3 months and to keep an eye out for pests and things like that. If you want real pros to come by, take care of your fertilizing with organic products like compost tea. If you want somebody that will put out nematodes whenever they're needed, this is just one of the newest services Sam is offering. He's still available for individual consultation, and he loves to do that. But I love this new service. It's just there are no contracts. There's no long-term obligation. It's just the way business should be done. If you want to learn more, go to his website, greengroworganics.com. Give him a call if you like, 210-599-5565. Sam Sitterly and Green Grow Organics.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster.
News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening, back to the phone lines. Kathleen is next in line. Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have a question. I finally got up early enough to catch an open line. yeah. Okay, I have a Meyer's lemon that we got. We live in the country from a local woman around here, and it she was a transplant. Got it when it was a little baby, and it's about 3.5 years old. You know, we've been taking care of it, my husband mainly, but just kind of wondering, how long do they take before they get fruit?
Well, was this plant grown from a seed from someone who had one? Is that the way it started? Okay.
Yes.
Well, it's not necessarily a Meyer's lemon. It was, know, it's mommy was a Meyer's lemon and his daddy was probably a Meyer's lemon. But the offspring can be highly varied. I mean, if you had 1,000 seeds from a plant, the genetic makeup of every one of those seeds is going to be just slightly different. Now, it's probably going to be very much like a Meyer's lemon. It could be a little worse, or it could be a little bit better. That's the only way we get new things is through cross-pollination. But anyway, to answer your question, it normally takes 5 to 6 years before they are physiologically mature. It has nothing to do with physical size, but they have to mature to be able to reproduce. And this is why if you get one that's cutting grown or one that's grafted, that wood's already mature. It can have fruit the first year, but if you're going to grow from seed, you have to be a little bit more patient. But if this is 3 years old, it could be a couple more years before you see fruit on it.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought, 4 to 5 years. It's about 3.5 years, and it's very lanky. Is that indicative of anything?
It just says it's just a young lemon tree, and kind of like a young lanky kid. It's going to probably grow up to be a pretty nice adult, but you can always trim. At this point, you're not worried about losing fruit, so trim however much and however you like. It's not going to set it back at all, and it's going to make it a little fuller and thicker. And this is the time of year that any true pruning, this is the time of year that your pruning is going to determine what the ultimate shape of the tree is going to be. So don't hesitate to get those pruning shears out if you need to.
Okay. That's good to know. My second question is, we have several varieties of tomatoes. We got beaucoups of them, but they're not turning red very much. And I know it's, you know, cooler out and all that, but is there anything we should do? I mean,
you can pray for 90 degree weather again if you want to, but I'm not going to. It's just, and you hit it right, the nail right on the head. It's just they are much slower to mature and color up. Believe it or not, you know, they'll turn color a little faster if you want to pick them and just ripen them in your windowsill. The longer they stay on the plant, the more flavorful they become. But it can be an exercise, and, you know, it's just very frustrating when they just sit and sit and sit, and just the day they start to turn color, the bird gets them or the squirrel gets them or whatever else. So I would probably tend to leave the smaller ones on the plant, perhaps pick some of the bigger ones to ripen in the windowsill just so you'll have plenty of good fresh eating.
Yeah, and then we'll have some fried green tomatoes.
that's a wonderful traditional Southern dish, which I find absolutely delicious. So not a bad thing
too.
At all. Yeah,
I do too. Okay. Oh, my husband wanted me to ask you one variety we have, and I don't know where he got these. They weren't, you know, at a great nursery, but one says semi-determinate. What does that mean?
Tomatoes are they're generally categorized into two groups, and in this case, three. They're indeterminates, and there are what they call determinants. Determinate tomatoes grow to a given size, produce all their fruit at one time, and then just stop growing. That's all you're ever going to see from them. Indeterminates tend to grow as a big vine. And somebody told me that on the Big Island of Hawaii, if you're going up toward the volcanoes, there's a spot along the road where there's one plant that's like 2 miles long or something like that. So indeterminates are basically big vines. Semi-determinates were developed for the commercial tomato farmers that want to pick all the fruit at once and then start over. A semi-determinate is somewhere in between. It doesn't produce all its fruit at one time. It spreads the fruit out over a little bit longer period of time, but it doesn't grow 8 feet tall the first 3 or 4 months like a so-called cherry tomato or some of the other indeterminates will. Right. So semi-determinants are some of the best for the home garden, I'll just put it that way. Celebrity is the best known of the semi-determinate ones, and it's still just a staple in the garden. I plant lots of fun, different things, things I want to experiment, but I always plant a few celebrities.
Okay. All right, that's good. Now, I have one last question. You know, for years I've heard you say, you know, when you water, water thoroughly, and then you, the next time you check it, stick your finger in. And all, we live in an RV, and we have a big deck, and we, that all our plants are in containers.
Okay.
So when you say water thoroughly, does that mean, okay, the water, and maybe I sound like an idiot, but the water goes out into the saucer, do you dump that water out, or is that where watered, or what?
That's actually a great question. When the plants, if the plants dry out a little bit too much, then the soil kind of pulls away from the side of the pot, and the water you put on, rather than soaking thoroughly through the root ball, may just run down the side and out into the saucer, and you think it's watered, and it's really not. So where you're doing that, I would let the water stand in the saucer for 2 or 3 or 4 hours. If it's still there after that length of time, then it indicates the root ball is pretty well saturated, and you can just pour the water in the saucer out. But I would leave it in there for a little while, because if the soil ball is really dried out, it will draw that water back up into it. Since you're living that fun lifestyle of being wherever you want to be when you want to be there, if you want to avoid, you know, running over and damaging the inside of your RV, you can always water with ice. Doesn't hurt plants to have a little bit of cold. And there are a handful of super sensitive things I wouldn't necessarily put ice on, but all your vegetables and things like that. Ice melts so slowly, it's 100% absorbed. Until the soil gets thoroughly saturated, and you won't have the problem with the water running through and collecting. And for years, when my partner and I first started in business, before we managed to open our nursery, we took care of plants and office buildings and restaurants and things like that. And there was one restaurant in particular had a huge collection of hanging baskets in the front window. It was called Crystal Baking Company. And I miss Joe Friesenhahn's restaurant. That was the best place to eat. But he never wanted water dripping on his customers. So every plant in that place got watered with ice, and it was very successful.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, those are all the burning questions I've had for years. So thank you, Bob.
You be like Willie Nelson and get on the road again, and we will look forward to helping you.
Our RV is stationary. We live out like 20 miles outside of Dripping Springs, so it's very hilly and rocky, and getting this RV out here was a act of God, so it's not going anywhere.
Well, I understand that. Well, you guys enjoy, and always call me if you have any questions, Kathleen. Always here to help you.
Okay. Thank you, Bob.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Goodbye. All right, let's pause for a moment and talk about nature's creation. And they want me to spend a special bit of time talking about their organic cactus and succulent mix. And name might be a little bit misleading because it's good for a lot more than just cacti and succulents. It is 100% organic. You're not going to find any peat moss. You're not going to find any biosolids. You're not going to find anything in that soil that you wouldn't want. But it's just been created to be especially well-draining, and that makes it great for begonias. It makes it great for a lot of houseplants, but it was specially formulated for cacti and succulents, and certainly works well for those. And boy, they are certainly a popular group of plants right now. Like all the products from Nature's Creation, things in there are natural. In this case, it is a truly organic mix, and I don't know, it's just good soil. We've carried it for a long time and used it for a lot of different plants. You're going to find that and other fine Nature's Creation products at, oh gosh, lots of good nurseries around. Bloomers, Rainbow Gardens, both locations. Milberger's carries it. We certainly have it here at Shades of Green, along with their other soils, their fungicidal cornmeal. Nature's Creations makes a lot of quality products. Look for them at your favorite nursery or garden center.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Jimmy tells me we pretty much got open lines. So if you want to avoid the busy signals, if you want to avoid having to wait a long time later in the show, you know the number to dial, 210-599-5555. We are live and local. Last week they pretty much just shut the station down so everybody could have a long Thanksgiving holiday. But glad to be back here with you today. So give me a call if you got a question or a comment, and you know the number, 210-599-5555. I will tell you that we were talking with a caller a minute ago about how beautiful the poinsettias and Christmas cactus and things are. Some of the things that you can plant in the beds outside are also spectacular this year. For those shady beds, cyclamen, there are some new varieties, two-tone colors of cyclamen out there that I've never seen before. The cyclamen are absolutely outstanding this year. And if you're looking for color in the shade, those and the primrose are also beautiful. Ornamental kale, ornamental cabbage. You do not have to have a drab yard in the winter just because you have a shady yard. Anywhere you're growing in patients or begonias or those things that don't take as much sunlight, there are things that will... things that will do well during the cool weather as well. And then, of course, out in the sunshine, the pansies, the Johnny Jump-Ups, those things are spectacular. They're going to bloom every day of the winter for you. They do need plenty of sunlight now. But pansies and little miniature pansies, we call Johnny Jump-Ups. Some people call them violas. That's actually sort of a mid-size. But those are things that you can count on that will consistently bloom no matter how cold the weather gets. Other things that you can certainly plant and are doing, I mean, just lots of flowers right now, snapdragons, dianthus, stock, alyssum, those are all things that tend to bloom profusely in the fall. Once it gets really cold, they stop blooming but continue to grow through the winter months, and then once again, you just have a huge show of color in the spring. So absolutely no reason to have a drab yard out there. They're just so many colorful, pretty things you can plant in the shade and in the sun. Also, golly, it's getting to be time now to plant bulbs for the spring. Bulbs don't bloom over a long period of time, but they'll probably be the first things to come in bloom in your garden in the spring. And I think they're just a lot of fun. The naturalizing narcissus I'd love, and they will come back year after year after year. The plants we call Lycoris, some people call them surprise lilies or probably some other different names they have for them, but they call them surprise lilies because the first thing that comes up and you see is the flowers and the foliage comes later. They come red, yellow, and a pink. I think the red are the most spectacular. And I've got a couple of areas around trees in my yard where just one day in the spring, you'll just look out there, January or so, and all of a sudden you've just got this huge burst of color out there. Those are your Lycoris coming up and doing their thing, and then they come up and put on the foliage and all. But other things you can plant, now, like I said, the naturalizing narcissus, Lycoris, the little bitty, some of the different little Things like grape hyacinths come back year after year. They can almost get to be a weed. But those are all definitely perennials in this area. Things that will usually come back for at least a couple of years include your hyacinths, include your bigger flower daffodils. They're not something that's going to be just a permanent part of your garden, but they are certainly colorful in the spring. Same thing goes for tulips. You have to really like tulips to plant them because they're usually just 1 year, and then you're not going to see them back again, but they sure are pretty while they're in bloom, and there's so many different, so many different colors of tulips out there. Anyway, it's time to get some of those bulbs planted. The so-called American amaryllis, now those you can plant out in the garden, and they'll come back year after year after year, the flower beds and wherever. The big old, what we call Dutch amaryllis or Hippiastrum, those are ones that have to be protected from freezing weather, but those are the spectacular ones that you'll get around this time of year to have in bloom over the holiday season. So anyway, I'm giving you a lot of fun things to do, but looks like we've got Kit and Billy waiting to talk, so let's get back to the phone calls, and Kit is first in line. Good morning, Kit.
Good morning, Bob. I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving and looking forward to Christmas.
Absolutely. I tell you, that turkey might have been the best turkey I've ever eaten. So, it was a great day. I love Christmas, but I just love Thanksgiving because we all have so much to be thankful for. And Christmas has gotten so much, they're so commercialized that Thanksgiving's just become one of my favorite holidays. And trust you and your family had a wonderful one as well.
Yes, we did. And for the first time, we got to eat three different dishes from homegrown sweet potatoes.
Well, now that's fun.
Yes, and, it was.
And it is one of those days where you're almost obligated to overeat. I mean, you just have to go for it when you know, and depending on how big your family is, you sometimes have a wide array of choices, but it's just extra special if you get to eat things grown from your own garden. And it sounds like you've had a chance to be a little creative this Thanksgiving.
I sure did. But my first question is on the sweet potatoes. So uh-huh. I grew both orange and white sweet potatoes. And I had some that, I'm not kidding you, came out the size of a small football. And
oh, yeah.
I had some that were just, you know, maybe an inch wide but 12 inches long.
Right.
So what is the reason for the it was orange and white both. Some of them were really large. Some of them were just like tubes. Is it the soil conditions? Is it not enough, fertilizer? I mean, what would be, because they both had nice green leaves throughout until I went to harvest them and everything. So,
well, and that's a great question. But a sweet potato doesn't ever ripen, so to speak. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I think the biggest one I ever saw weighed 40 pounds or something. You'd have to have a commercial oven to cook it. But it partly will depend on how many eyes were in, you know, that little slip that you started. And some varieties just grow faster. The overall shape is pretty much genetic. But it's just like you can plant 10 tomato plants and, you know, eventually they're all going to make nice big plants. But, you know, a month into growing, you're always probably going to have one or two plants that are extra big, and you're going to have one or two plants that are kind of lagging behind the others. And then you're going to have a lot of them in the middle. And that's kind of like your sweet potatoes. Some of them just got off to a really strong start, grew a lot of roots early on, and were simply able to grow bigger over a given period of time. And that's why some of them, you know, are a little bit larger than others. It might be one part of your garden got a little bit more fertilizer. Might be the vines, some of them shaded themselves out a little bit more, where the other ones, and you know what a forest of vines they make. But it's...
Oh, yeah.
It's not like a plant that grows, matures, and then you harvest it at a peak of perfection.
Okay.
You know, when I'm growing sweet potatoes, rather than just go dig, I'll take my index finger and go probing around in the soil and try to, you know, try to find the ones that are the size that I want to harvest, because some of them are always going to get extra large, and those want to be the first ones you're going to harvest, unless you're just going to win a blue ribbon at the fair with them or something. But some of them simply take a little longer to develop, and if you pull them all the way out of the ground, well, you pretty much... You've really slowed them down then, so I kind of like the my index finger is my ground penetrating radar to tell me how big they are, and but it's okay. Not an unusual situation. It's not at all abnormal, and what they are a true tuber growing on the root, so that's going to influence a little bit the shape that they ultimately take. But they're all good. Some of them are just bigger than others.
Okay. Well, I started adding some Medina, was it soil activator, to make the soil a little looser, hoping that would encourage them to grow. So we'll see how that comes out next year.
Absolutely. And the thing to realize about soil activator is it's not a one-time thing. It kind of depends on where you started with your soil, but it just tends to get better and better and better. But the kind of soils we have around here, you may use it for a few years before you start, you know, saying, gosh, my soil's just in absolutely perfect condition. So great stuff, but it doesn't produce overnight results.
Okay. So moving on to my next question, can garlic and onions be grown in the same garden or near each other?
Sure. Sure.
Okay.
You're going to, I don't pick all my onions at one time, because I like green onions on the grill. I like the little pearl size onions, and then I like a nice big slicing onion as well. So you've probably heard me say this before, but I'll plant my row of onions fairly close together, and then at some point I'll go through and pull up every other one to enjoy as a small onion.
Yep.
A few weeks later I'll go back and pull up every other one, and you know, have some that are a little bit bigger, and then finally by, you know, early hot weather, that's when I'm going to have my full-size bulb onions. Garlic, on the other hand, I pretty much plant it all at once, and I harvest it all at once. I'm going to leave that whole row of garlic in place until early summer when the tops start to fall over. Then I'm going to harvest them and dry them and store them. So, yes, they are very compatible, but you're going to harvest them differently, so don't plant them in such a way that it would make it difficult to do. Does that make sense?
Okay. Makes perfect sense. Very, very good. All right. And then I got two more questions for you. One, we have in our flower garden, we have things like Mystic Blue Sylvia, Anise, how you say it, Anise Leg, Live, whatever, and then Pink Skull Cap and Blue Basil Spice. Those plants have gotten to be like they're 3-4 foot tall. Is it okay if we cut them back down at the base and let them grow up again next spring? And if so, when do we cut them?
Well, the problem with that is that when you cut them back, you're going to stimulate new growth. And that new growth is not going to be cold hardy. And if we get a heavy frost or a hard freeze right after they've tried to come out, that's really going to set the plants back. They're not like woody shrubs that are going to go, you know, semi-dormant. So if you want to prune on them lightly, do so, but I wouldn't give them a major haircut until, you know, we've had some frost, until they kind of freeze back naturally, because the last thing you want is to have them come sprouting out. Now, things like your African blue basil, that's about our only true perennial basil. And you can let it grow, you know, all winter long. You don't have to prune any of these things back. But at this point, I would think of any pruning as sort of a manicure, not a full shaving of the scalp.
And, not a full shaving. Okay.
Yeah. Now, once they freeze, assuming we get freezing weather, and we almost certainly will, at that point, yeah, cut them way down, keep them well mulched, and they, as long as the soil stays cold, as long as the weather stays cool, they're not going to come sprouting back up until sometime in the spring. And hopefully we won't have one of those years where it gets warm early and then gets really cold again. But This shrubs, anything else, this is just really not a good time of year to be doing a lot of pruning. It looked, last time I looked at the weather forecast, which was yesterday evening, we're in for 4, 5, 6 days of weather in the 70s, and I don't want to be pruning things back just to have them come out and then really freeze back. So put the pruning shears away, but keep the trowel and the shovel handy.
Yep. Okay, and then last question for you. We have a bunch of oak trees where the branches of, looking for sunlight, they've grown way down low to the ground. Mm-hmm. But to get back to where the split is, so you can do a nice clean cut, it is, up in the tree, 10, 14 feet up in the tree. Mm-hmm. I can get a pole saw up there to cut, but how do I paint that in so that it's no longer, that so I'm doing the proper pruning and cleaning technique when I cut that tree branch?
It'll be just like your pole saw, whether it's I have an electric pole saw and I love that thing, but
yep, me too.
God, I love steel. Anyway, there is a little device, you can put it on the end of a telescoping pole just like you do your pole saw, that is made to hold the can of spray paint. And then you've simply got a cord that comes down. You pull the cord. It depresses the plunger on the spray can. It's important, and I'm sure you've done plenty of spray painting in your life, when you get through painting, you turn that can upside down and clear that nozzle. You let some air blow through so it doesn't clog up on you. It's important after you get through that you take your whatever you're using to seal those wounds, that you clear the nozzle on that. But they make a, and it's just, it looks almost like a little basket up on the end, and it's got a cord that hangs down, and you reach up to that wound and depress it, and be prepared to get a little bit of paint on yourself. Don't wear your Sunday best to get out and do this, but they make a couple of very effective little pole painters, I guess you could call them. It's not like trying to, in my younger years, I taped a paintbrush to the end of a pole, but they've come out with some better things like that. And you certainly don't have to use pruning paint. You can use any kind of paint. You only have to keep it sealed for about 10 days. And after that time, the wound's dry enough, the oak wilt can't get in. But, wherever you got your pole pruner, they'll probably have a pole painter as well.
Okay. That sounds great. All right, Bob, that's all my questions this morning.
Good questions, Kit. Get out and have a wonderful day, and I know we'll talk again sometime soon. Thank you so much.
Yes, sir. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. All right, let's take a quick break here. Billy is our next caller, and then we'll move right on down. Do have some open lines, so get in line, and I look forward to talking to you. Right now, I get to talk to you about Fanix Nursery and Garden Center, and Fanix, they've started getting their poinsettias in and Christmas cacti as well, but they really are stocking up now on fruit trees. Getting a lot of containerized fruit trees this year. I love that because that knocks about a year off the time to production compared to planting a bare root tree. They're simply finding that they can get deals almost as good as bare root, and they're getting a lot more of their fruit trees already in containers and ready to go into the ground. Getting real well stocked up on them. They also have a lot of shade trees that will qualify for that green tree shade rebate program that CPS does every year. Lots of perennials. They've got onions. They've got garlic by the pound. Lots of wintertime vegetables. Lots of wintertime flowers. And all those organic gardening products you need to get your plants ready for wintertime. The good organic fertilizers and products from Medina and all the great companies out there. Fanix is open 7 days a week to serve you now. I doubt they'll be closed again until Christmas. Right over there on Home Green Road, where they've been for about 90 years. Check their website, Fanic, F-A-N-I-C-K, FanicNursery.com, for events and even more information. Great place to shop, Fanix Nursery and Garden Center.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550, KTSA, and FM 1071.
All right, let's get back to gardening. And I believe next in line is going to be, it's Billy. Good morning, Billy.
Morning, Bob. I'm kind of curious, was that turkey deep fried?
No, this was done in the oven with some of the just most wonderful dressing. And golly, it was just an, I don't know, maybe I was hungrier than usual, but I don't think so, because it also made pretty good turkey spaghetti afterwards and a few other things. But it was a wonderful Thanksgiving around our place. Hope it was around yours too.
Oh yeah, we thoroughly enjoyed it. Bob, I got some of the prettiest fall tomatoes. My spring didn't do anything.
But yours and everybody else's.
And their cherries, they're not ripening, and I threatened them the other day to feed them to the goats, and they're starting to ripen. I guess just sit there and be patient.
That's all you can do, unless you want to pick them and put them in the, you know, bright window, and they will ripen. They won't be quite as good a flavor, but they'll still be a whole lot better than you get at the grocery store. But it's just the cool weather. Tomatoes to color up, to get that pigment in the skins, it simply takes warm weather. Now, this is going to be a week of weather in the 70s if the weathermen get it right for once. So things are going to ripen a little bit more quickly this week because it will be warmer. But as one of my earlier callers said, you know, you always have fried green tomatoes too. But on your cherries especially, they're taste better if they, you know, if they are colored up. But you can ripen them in the windowsill if you're worried about a hard freeze or something. Otherwise, just be patient. It's a natural thing for them to ripen much more slowly when the nights are down in the 40s. I had 42 degrees this morning when I left home, so... it slowed them down from where they were.
Okay, well, we'll just be a little more patient. And my son brought a Malabar spinach, one little transplant, and my God, I've never seen anything that evasive in my life. That thing has just attacked the tomatoes, my okra, everything.
Yep. Well, it's going to... It's going to freeze and die. It's not going to be the thing that took over the whole world. If you know, it's probably going to come back from seed, or you can harvest some seed. But yeah, it's not a spinach at all. I don't think it even tastes like spinach, but a lot of people like it and use it as a spinach substitute. But botanically it's called dolichos, but it's an annual vine. Pretty little flowers. Tell you what, if you want to hang on a minute, I've got to take a news break. Be right back here on KTSA Radio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening. I think everybody's a little slow getting up this morning because Jimmy tells me we still do have some open lines out there. And you know what happens once we get a little bit later into the show? Everything gets jammed up and you have long waits. So, you want to get through, give me a call right now, 210-599-5555, while I visit with Mike. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, sir.
On these burrs that I asked you about a week or so ago, the carillos, I had put some of that, the orange oil in the...
And vinegar,
Vinegar down right on it, and then covered up with a little bit of dirt. And they look, well, the ones that somehow still seem to appear, they look pretty, like, dry.
Uh-huh.
But they still manage to stick to my shower shoes, right?
Right.
Are those still able to propagate, or... are they pretty much dead because of the orange oil and the vinegar?
It depends on how mature they were when they got treated. It's the combination of orange oil and strong vinegar. The orange oil just softens them up, so to speak. The orange oil is a solvent that makes the acid in the vinegar. Vinegar, you know, is just basically a mild acid, but it does a lot to kill green vegetation. Doesn't really necessarily get the roots of things, but it's just acetic acid is all it is. So the orange oil softens it up. The acetic acid does the killing. So it just, once you hit those plants with it, it pretty much shut down anything maturing further. It just kind of depends on how mature those seeds were at the time you did it. So probably some of them are going to come back up anyway. Probably most of them are not. This is why I always recommend, you know, putting down some compost as well, because compost is probably the best natural pre-emergent in the world. And it's the humic acids or lots of different things in there that work as natural pre-emergent. So you've gone a long way towards stopping the problem, but you can't just sit back now and think that everything's taken care of, because you're still going to have a few of them come up, considering that they were there when you started.
Well, they weren't very mature. They were just starting to come up.
Well, chances are that you've gotten 90% of them at least.
Fantastic. All right, Bob, appreciate it.
Always good to hear from you. Get out and enjoy this beautiful weekend.
Oh, definitely. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. Chad's next in line, and then it'll be George. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing extremely well. That was a nice short wait, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Dialed at the right time. How can I help today?
Well, I've got my my backyard, and my lawn was pretty much killed by the drought and my big dogs. And I put out some perennial ryegrass seed. But my question is, what should I do to get St. Augustine going? I have a mixture of a lot of weeds and Bermuda grass, and I would love it very much if I didn't have any Bermuda grass in my backyard. And
well,
I could get some St. Augustine going.
Yeah, St. Augustine is the strongest grass out there. And if you're able to take care of it, which means watering it, which we weren't able to do much of this summer, St. Augustine will choke out Bermuda. It will choke out every weed out there. But in a dry condition, Bermuda's going to dominate. Bermuda's always going to be stronger where you can't give it water. To get the St. Augustine going, you can't plant St. Augustine seed. It doesn't, there's no such thing available as St. Augustine seed. So it's going to be a matter of, you know, planting in some little sprigs, planting in some little squares of it. Years ago, a nursery I worked for, we grew a lot of our own grass, had several acres of grass, and believe me, I learned how to use a sod cutter, and that was back in the days when most people didn't just go in and lay wall-to-wall sod. You chopped it up in small pieces and spread it out, and it only took about a 50th as much grass. But it just depends on how patient you are. What direction do you live? You way up in the hill country, down south? What direction?
Oh, I'm way up. I'm west of Waco.
Okay. I would not suggest doing it at this time of year. We're just likely to get weather that is too cold. If you told me you were down by Pleasanton, I'd tell you go out and buy some sod and plant it this afternoon. But focus on getting the soil ready. Put out, even though you, you know, may not feel like you want to encourage what's out there. Put out some Medina soil activator, spray some molasses on the soil. These are things that will pick up microbial life, will start softening the soil, will start improving the soil so that when you get ready to plant your grass, you can just put down some organic fertilizer, plant your St. Augustine, and if the weather cooperates, it will choke out the troublesome things. In the meantime, I would mow the weeds just to cut down on seed production. The Bermuda's going to brown out with the first frost if it hasn't already. But, you know, you're not going to get rid of it by anything you do this fall. If you can put a thin layer of compost over it, thin being quarter to a half an inch, that's going to do more than any single thing you can do to prepare that soil, to soften it up, to work as a natural pre-emergent herbicide against the seeds and things that are already there. I consider if you're only going to do one thing to your soil, I'd tell you to put compost out. But if you can follow that up with some molasses, if you can, you know, follow it up with some Medina Plus, you'll be ready to plant your St. Augustine in the spring, and it will take off and grow very much more quickly.
Okay, and do I need to do anything when I do plant it? As in, you know, do I need to break up the soil or what's there? Or
no.
Do I need to just
No, and that's another good question, because seeds can remain buried below the soil and remain viable for years, and they're not going to come up unless they get up on top of the ground. You go through and start tilling it up and things like that, you'll have weeds like you've never seen before. So at this point, let what you're doing just work from the top down. Especially planting grass, when it's time to plant it, you're going to mow it as low as you possibly can, rake the debris away so your new sod makes good contact with the soil underneath. But no, there's minimal physical effort involved over the winter months. When it's time to plant, if you've got a big area, and especially if you're going to lay it in solid, get some adult beverage and call every friend you've got and turn it into a party instead of a day's work. But right now, no, you're just going to work on building the soil, mowing to cut down on as much seed production as you can. And that thin layer of compost is going to be some work, but you don't have to do it all in one day.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And I have one more question, if that's all right.
Go right ahead, Chad.
So I planted an apricot tree in my front yard because I think they're a nice looking tree, and maybe occasionally I'll get an apricot. But I've been training it with a central leader because I think that looks nice. Was anything wrong with it? I know they generally are not trained that way.
No, they're usually grown more as a bush. The problem with apricots is that they tend to bloom too early. The blooms freeze, and then you don't get any fruit. It takes a very special year. They came out at one point with an apricot called Golden Amber that bloomed over a longer period of time, so you had a better chance of getting apricots with that one, but I really haven't seen much of it the past couple of years. The old standard ones, Moor Park is a good old-fashioned one. Blenheim is another good old-fashioned one, but and they're great trees. They're easy to grow. They're beautiful when they're in bloom, but the fact that they tend many times to bloom too early and then the fruit freezes, that's why you don't get a good crop every year. But good plants to grow, and where you are, they should do very well for you. Training them to a single leader, single trunk is just fine.
Okay. All right. Yeah, this is the Chinese or Mormon variety, and yeah, it's in my front yard, and I just think it's a nicer looking tree, you know, for aesthetics than a peach tree or something, in my opinion.
Well, to each their own. Fruit trees, to me, I look at the fruit. I don't look at the tree nearly as much.
Yeah.
But now you're, it is an apricot. It's not what they call a Chinese plum, which is a loquat.
No, it's an apricot. It's the Chinese or Mormon is the variety, but it's apricot. Yeah.
Okay. Very good. Well, good luck with it, and just hope that when that we don't get, what happens is just, you know, we can get a warm spell in January, and that's when people that planted low chilling peaches, people that plant apricots, things like that, the blasted things just start blooming out too early, then freezes back and limits the fruit production. But every now and then you get a year where everything goes right, and my gosh, there's just nothing better than a fresh apricot.
No, I remember having them from my aunt's tree, so that's kind of why I planted one.
Good for you. Well, very good. Anything else I can help you with?
That's it. I appreciate it very much. Thank you, Bob.
It's my pleasure, Chad. Thank you for the call this morning. George, hang on just a second. I've got to get a break in here. Looks like I get to talk about Kinetico. I love my Kinetico water softener. I feel sorry for my friends with the electronic ones because they're always having problems. Something happened to the computer, or they had a power failure and the thing didn't produce any soft water. They're two types of water softeners. There are those standard ones that you plug in that run on electricity and have that little computer in there. And then there's Kinetico. Doesn't need electricity. Runs on the kinetic energy and water, hence the name. Kinetico systems don't recharge on a preset basis. They only recharge when the rosin needs to be recharged, and that saves you a lot of salt and a lot of money. And yet you never run out of soft water because it's a twin tank system. They're very, very reasonably priced. They'll even let you try them for 90 days before you pay for them if you like. It's just, I don't know, it's as the commercial says, it's the last water softener you will ever own. I've had my Kinetico for years, and I absolutely love it. If it's time for a water softener or time for a new water softener, why not just take a moment and check out Kinetico? You can give them a call at 210-656-PURE. You can go online at kineticosa.com. I like to think of it as the thinking man's water softener, Kinetico.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. I believe George is next in line. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm off to a good start, back to wearing shorts for a few days, so this is my kind of fall weather. How about
yes,
yourself?
Sir. Doing okay for an old man. Say, I've got a new dog pen. What would be a good grass to plant in that?
What kind of dogs?
Well, mixed breed.
Okay, maybe I should say, how large are the dogs? How much do they weigh?
Oh, I imagine 50 pounds anyway.
Oh, okay. Well, you're going to have trouble trying to grow grass in there. You know, if you told me they were, 10-pound dogs, 12-pound dogs, that would be a different story. Your best grass, if your dog run is sunny, the so-called TIFF, T-I-F-F, the TIFF Bermuda varieties, TIFF Green, TIFF right. Way, are by far the most foot tolerant. That's what they use on, golf courses, on driving ranges, right. Things like that. Your TIFF Bermuda is your toughest grass, but when you realize that those dogs are probably going to run that pen 10 hours a day, it's going to be hard to... It is going to be hard to keep any grass alive. I am not a fan of plastic grass, but let me tell you, in a situation like that, it may be what you ultimately have to go to. You need something you can clean up pretty well, something you can get out there with a hose or whatever. But if you want to try grass, TIFF is by far the hardiest and best. And I've never really thought about this, but, In the cattle business, we talk all the time about rotational grazing, where we have right. more than one paddock or pasture, so we can put the cows on one for a while the other recovers and kind of move them around. I mean, if your yard is big enough that you could have like two runs for them, and you let them stay in one run for a week while the other one recovers, if you can move them back and forth, I don't know if that's at all possible or practical. But I think that's something like that's going to be your only chance to really have a good run. Now, if you had a big yard, sure, and you can direct the dogs around different parts of the yard, no trouble at all maintaining nice grass. But those little feet, just hour after hour, day after day, it's going to be hard to find any grass that's really going to stay good looking. But TIFF Bermuda is going to be your best choice.
Yeah, is that something that could be planted this time of year?
I wouldn't recommend it. If you were doing a yard, yeah, you could plant it this year and the roots would take off and grow, but just running back and forth on it, the dogs are going to keep it from being able to put any roots down. I do it early in the spring as soon as the soil starts to warm, but I really think you'd be throwing your money away at this time of the year.
Right. Okay, fine. Thank you, Bob. Have a good day.
I wish I could tell you what you want to hear, but this little thing inside me, what was it Mark Twain said? The best way not to have to remember what you told somebody is just tell the truth. So it's I wish there were a good answer to that, but there's just no magic bullet out there. But let me put it this way. Even Dr. Kirby has some plastic grass in his yard with all his dogs, so it might be something you want to consider.
Yeah. Would ryegrass do any good this time of year for that?
Oh, ryegrass grows and it's absolutely beautiful this time of year, especially if you get the top flight or playmate or some of the, they call them perennial, but they're really not perennial. They're only going to last up well into the hot weather in the summer, but yeah, they'll sprout overnight, and it would be great if you could keep the dogs off of them for a few days till they at least get up and
right.
running. But ryegrass is a great thing to place where you're looking at mud right now.
Okay, great. Thank you much, and have a good day.
You do the same, sir. Thanks for the call this morning. Next in line is Debbie. Good morning, Debbie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My brother gave me some grow bags.
Okay.
And I have a sweet potato that is sprouting.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm just wondering if I can cut the end off of that and maybe put it in some water to get some roots growing. And I don't know what to put, what kind of dirt to put in the grow bags.
Well,
and I'm just starting learning about all that.
Absolutely. We're all learning. Some of them just sit a little bit further down the road. But your grow bags, you want to just fill them with a good potting soil. They're just, and nothing wrong with them. They make a fabric bag. They make all kinds of, and just think of it as a flexible flower pot, is what you've got there. And just a good potting soil in it, like, you know, you would use, if you're filling just a flower pot. So that's pretty easy. Now, with your sweet potato, you don't normally, you know, cut a whole lot of it off until, you know, it has some, you know, fair amount of little leaves on there. A lot of people will take and just stick three or four toothpicks into the side of the potato, suspend it in a glass of water, and then let it just grow through the winter and, you know, just vine it. Each one of those little growths coming out will make a vine with leaves. Then as we get a little bit closer to spring, you can go in with a very sharp knife and sort of take a little wedge of sweet potato along with some vine. Some people plant them directly into the ground. I think you're more successful if you put those little individual slips into some perlite for a while and let them actually get some good roots started on them. But at this point, I guess if you wanted to, you could cut the potato in half, let that cut side callus for a while before you put it. But most people would just suspend the whole potato, you know, probably halfway down in the water, and just put that jar of water and potato in a sunny window, and you'll have lots of slips to plant as the weather warms up. But you're not going to put your sweet potatoes outside at this time of year anyway.
Mm. Okay. What would be a good thing to plant in there? When would we do the sweet potatoes, I guess?
Well, sweet potatoes are a warm weather plant. Unlike the so-called white potatoes or Irish potatoes, which we plant normally in February, not usually going to plant sweet potatoes until March or April. But if you want to get some good weather, wintertime veggies growing, spinach is a wonderful thing to plant, either from seed or as little plants. If you like kale, you can plant kale. I like especially the so-called dino kale or Toscano kale. You can plant chard, you can plant bok choy. I love baby bok choy. It's so easy to grow, it's so delicious. But lettuce, any of the leafy greens will do well. You will start not from seed, but from little plants if you want to grow broccoli or cauliflower. It's getting a little late for Brussels sprouts, but broccoli, cauliflower, and cabbage, all of those can be planted now, and they'll be, you know, a few weeks down the road, you'll be harvesting big heads of cauliflower and broccoli in from a grow bag. So those would be, you know, very good things to plant. If you wanted to, you could plant some root vegetables like radishes or beets or carrots or turnips. Those are things you would plant from seed. But as long as you have good sunlight, you've got a wide range of cool weather vegetables you can grow.
Okay, awesome. Is there anything else I need to know?
Well, I would probably mix a little bit of slow-release organic fertilizer in the soil before you put it in your grow bags. And lots and lots of sunlight. If you want to grow veggies, it's easy to do, but it's going to need to be in a sunny area. But beyond that, no, it's just decide what you want to grow. If you're over in our part of town at any point, we actually have a little free handout we'll give you that gives our recommended planting dates, both spring and fall, for all the things that you're likely to want to grow in your garden and how much you space them out, which ones you plant from plants, which ones you plant from seed. But you can always just call me and ask. It's most of your leafy veggies can be planted either from seed or plants. Your coal family, which is your broccoli, cauliflower, and cabbage, those almost have to be set out as plants. Or, in, you know, some things you can go either way. Just thinking, sitting here thinking, you could also use one of them. You could plant some garlic if you wanted, and you'll have nice fresh garlic next summer. You could plant some onions. There are more things actually you can plant during cool weather than there are during the hot season.
I'm taking notes. Okay, great. Well, the great thing, I guess, about the bags is that we can move them wherever the sun is.
Well, you can do that, but realize once you fill them with dirt and start watering, they're going to be kind of heavy. So you might want to, okay. You know, you might want to get one of these little plant trolley things we normally set pots on so we can roll them around. You might want to take one of those and put a little round chunk of wood or something at the bottom that you can set your grow bag on top of, and that way they'll be easier to manipulate. That bag of soil that weighs 10 pounds when it's dry is going to weigh 45 or 50 pounds when it gets watered.
Okay.
Don't want to be sending you to the chiropractors, but I want to see you grow a good garden, and it's amazing how many different things you grow. If you like spinach, be sure to plant some spinach because it's so successful through the winter months. The reason I didn't say Brussels sprouts are very cold tolerant. Some of the prettiest ones I ever saw were in a friend's garden in Albuquerque in January when it was 5 degrees or something like that. But Brussels sprouts take a long time to produce, and if you plant them this late, they may or may not be able to produce before it gets warm in the spring. But things like broccoli and cauliflower, you're just waiting 35 or 40 days before you're going to be harvesting from them. So ideal time to get those started. So you're going to have a lot of fun. There are a lot of things you'll be able to grow.
Wow. What kind of spinach? Is there some that's better?
Well, good question. There are basically two types of wintertime spinach. One of them is what we call, and there are just several different names, several different varieties. But one type is called Savoy, and they're sort of a curly spinach. They're Savoy types, and then they're the flat leaf types. The flat leaf types grow a little faster, produce a little bit more, but they don't grow as long into the spring. The Savoy types, which are the ones that I prefer, I'm usually still picking spinach Mother's Day or sometimes even later. The flat leaf forms, there's several different varieties. They play out a little bit earlier in the spring, so I'd maybe plant, you know, some of both. One other thing I should mention, if you want to have some fun, you can grow snow peas. If you like edible pod peas, you would want to get a bush form as opposed to a vining form. But your snow peas would be another thing. It'd be a lot of fun to grow in a grow bag.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. It sounds fun.
you're gonna find so many different things. You're gonna be running to get some more of them, or else you're gonna ask for some more of them as a Christmas present. I can tell. So, you get out and enjoy, and you call me anytime you have questions.
Thanks, Bob.
My pleasure always. Thank you. Goodbye. All right, Omar, hang on just a second. We do need to get a break in here. Looks like I get to talk to you about Medina products, and that's always such a pleasure because Medina makes so many fine things. And fertilizers, this is a very important time of year to be fertilizing. It's probably the single most important time of the year that you'll be putting out fertilizer because it helps your plants become more winter hardy, and it helps them absorb and use and get the nutrients in that they will need for a burst of spring growth. You know, fertilizer is not used instantly. It takes a while to be processed by the microbes in the soil and by the plants. So actually, when we feed in the fall, we're getting ready for our spring growth. And Medina has great products. They're growing green fertilizer. I use it on grass, trees, shrubs, ground covers, the whole works. They're liquid products like the Has-to-Grow plant, the Has-to-Grow lawn. Not going to be using as much Has-to-Grow lawn this time of year, but Has-to-Grow plants is what we basically use in all our greenhouses and everything around the nursery. Their liquid fish blend, also a great fertilizer for things in pots and in the ground both. And then, of course, you've got your soil activators and your Medina Plus to help soften the soil over time. You've got your humates, liquid and dry. Medina packages some of the best orange oil, some of the best molasses you'll find anywhere. They're just a lot of quality products. If you're going to see them all, just go to MedinaAg.com. But if you want to pick them up and hold them in your hand, just go to a good nursery or garden center that believes in quality. You'll find lots of fine products from Medina.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening. My next two callers are going to be Omar and Debbie. Omar's first in line. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Bob. How you doing?
It's just going to be another nice fall day out there. A little bit on the warm side, and that's fine by me.
Yeah. Well, I've got an interesting question. You know, given our current political situation and the fear of round two happening next time, I've gotten a little more serious of my gardening.
Very and good.
Started to can a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And I've got four jalapeno plants, and the jalapenos got nothing. No heat, not a bit. Never have had that happen to me before. I checked the tags, and there were bonnie plants, and said hot pepper, but I canned a bunch of them, and like I said, no heat. I've tasted a pepper from each plant fresh, and nothing.
Okay. Well, I have to tell you, bonnie plant farmers, let's just say they grow for the mass market, and they don't put quite the care and caution into it that that a grower who's I wouldn't trust the tags. They're growing for the the Home Depots and the HEBs and things like that. So I hear fairly often that people didn't get what they expected.
So it's probably just mislabeled?
It probably just mislabeled. Yeah, almost certainly just mislabeled. There's just not reason, no reason I can think of that an experienced gardener, especially in a hot, dry summer, if anything, you'd expect things to be a little bit hotter than they normally were. But they're already pickled in the jars and everything.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I've tasted them after the canning and then fresh right off the plant.
And what I'm going to tell you, I think the best way you're going to be able to enjoy them is to, unfortunately go to the store and get some of them that are hot, either serranos or jalapenos or whatever, and mix them up, chop them up together, and you can still make some darn good salsa or hot sauce or pico de gallo or whatever you're going to use them for. But I would I'd blend them up, since I think you're a guy who likes some heat things, maybe more than I do. But there's no way that you're gonna make them hot once they're mild. Now, I guess it's tough peppers, because they are pretty acidic, and the ways that we pickle them and all, we're using a high acid situation, so there's much less chance that you're going to get some bad toxin in there like you could with beans or some other things. So I'm really not concerned about the fact that you might open the bottles and yet they might be in the bottle for a while before you actually use them. You could go back and add some serranos or some of the super hot jalapenos that you can get, if not at the grocery store, at some of the specialty markets. But I truly think you probably got some mislabeled plants, and it might not have even been the grower's fault. I watch people going through our display of things, pulling out a tag, reading it, and putting it back in the wrong pot. And you kind of go through and try to straighten things out afterwards where you can. But I don't think you got hot jalapenos.
I haven't seen for sale, university, I guess it was University of New Mexico and A&M that bred those types of jalapenos. I've never seen them for sale.
They're usually available in the early spring. I don't usually see them when people are getting ready for a fall garden, but in the early spring, they simply call them a TAM, mild jalapeno. And, if you can't find them next spring, call around and I'll, or call me and I'll try to find some for you. Cause I know Fanix usually carries them. We carry them. There are a few other people that, are pretty good about, we just have to fuss at our growers. I mean, this time of year, we're already making lists for, you know, what we want them to grow for us this next spring. And a TM mild jalapeno, again, I wouldn't give you 2 cents for it, but it's one that normally, when you can it, it will be hot enough, as an old chef of mine, friend, used to say, to give it a little authority, but not going to burn you terribly. It's in my opinion, it's a great canning pepper. But oh man, I miss that gentleman. Yeah. He was an old Cajun, and God, did he ever know how to cook. We took some cooking classes from him, but that was one of his favorite expressions. His name was Bob Rutledge, and he used to say, "Yes, it's hot enough to have some authority." So, anyway,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
Is there any truth to the lines that are on the pepper signifying heat or more hot, or, you know, the little brown lines that you see on?
No. Okay. That's just a sign of maturity. I'm thinking another of Bob's expressions. He used to always say, "Mo hotter, mo better."
Yeah.
That sounds like that could be Omar's expression too.
Yeah, gotcha. Now, I had some people, you know, telling me that. I said, "Well, I don't know about all that, because I'm eating them right now, and there's nothing."
Yeah, no, the lines indicate that it was probably a little bit more mature, and so it was probably mean that it was at the peak of the heat, but also once they start getting those lines in them, they don't can as well. You don't want them to turn color at all. You know, virtually all peppers will turn red if they stay on the plant long enough. But once they start coloring up, you try to can them, they're going to be the mushiest things you've ever eaten.
Yeah, got it.
Do you have a copy of the University of Georgia book, So Easy to Preserve?
I've heard y'all talk about it, and I'm going to get it.
Well, ask for it, put it on your Christmas list. It's under $20, and it's just the Bible for anybody that wants to pickle or dry or preserve in any way. It's got a plastic spiral binder to it. They update it regularly, and they're just real stippers for safety in canning. But it's an excellent book. I've never had a canning question I didn't find answered there.
Gotcha. I'm going to get it.
You do it, Omar, and you have a good holiday season until we talk again.
All righty, sir. Appreciate it. You too.
I appreciate you. Thank you, sir. Goodbye. All right, Debbie, hang on just a second. Jimmy, don't have any lives. Run those recorded, and we'll get back, and Debbie will be first.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Actually, Ann was my next caller, but Jimmy said her line dropped. So, Ann, if you want to call back, do so. We've got about 8 minutes or so until 8 o'clock, after which we're going to be visiting with the dirt doctor, Mr. Howard Garrett. Right now, I guess I'll talk for a moment about just a couple of things that you really ought to be doing and getting ready for cold weather. Number one is fertilizing. The grass, the trees, the shrubs, everything in your landscape will be able to take the cold better if you give it some nutrition in the fall. The fall fertilizing helps plants build what amounts to antifreeze in their sap, and it's just super important. You're not trying to encourage new growth, but you very definitely will increase cold hardiness by feeding at this time of the year. Anything that is marginally cold hardy, and I'm talking about things like the Esperanzas that are still blooming beautifully around town, lots of different lantanas, lots of different perennials out there in bloom, or maybe even you've still got some of your houseplants out on the porch and things like that, spray with liquid seaweed. In the vegetable garden especially, you've still got some of those summertime plants hanging on, peppers, tomatoes, eggplant, things like that, spray with liquid seaweed. Liquid seaweed really does increase the cold hardiness of your plants, but you can't wait until the night before cold weather is forecast. But if you spray every couple of weeks, my actual formula that I use, I mix about 2 tablespoons of liquid seaweed, 1 tablespoon of molasses per gallon of water, and that will sometimes add as much as 5 degrees of cold hardiness to your plants, and it just keep them going through the winter a whole lot better. give them a better chance of staying evergreen all the way through until next summer. But those are important. I would stock up on insulate anyway, though, because chances are we're going to get some cold weather where you may have to cover some things. It looks like Ann was able to get back through, so good morning, Ann.
Hi, Bob. I'm sorry I had to go for a minute, but I'm glad I got you.
Yeah, I'm glad you got back.
Yes, thank you. I think I have grub worm damage to my St. Augustine. I'm pretty sure. Is there anything I can do now? And I need to know when to put out beneficial nematodes during the year.
Well, the best way to recover from both grub worm damage and from the kind of bad summer we had would be a thin layer of compost, like half an inch of compost over the area. That's going to protect what you have left, and it really does encourage good root growth, and not going to change a lot in this fall, but it will help the grass rebound next spring. So single most important thing I think would be the layer of compost. Fertilizer would be good if you have some green left, but
I've done that. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, then, and it's still good and green. I've got the palmetto, which I just love.
Oh, yeah, it's a great grass.
I had put out beneficial nematodes in the spring, and but was I supposed to do it again in the late summer or something? Or
again, you ask excellent questions. The beneficial nematode lives, when you put them out, the individual nematode lives for about 60 days or so. If the nematodes find a host to reproduce in, they can't reproduce just free ranging. They actually reproduce inside of an insect of some sort. Like in a grub worm, they say two nematodes get together in a grub worm, they can produce several thousand offspring. So if they're finding grubs, if they're finding fire ants, if they're finding fleas, the things that they normally parasitize, then their numbers stay up. But if there's nothing there, if they manage to wipe out all the grub worms that are there, then 60 days later or so, the nematodes are going to be virtually gone. We always have at least a few of them. But when we put them out, we're putting them out at the rate of like 200 nematodes per square foot, which is just going to overwhelm any grub worm infestation. So generally speaking, we recommend once in the spring, once in the early summer, if you're in an area. Now, if you are at home all the time, if you're not fortunate enough to take some of those long vacations that I wish I could take sometime, you can simply watch for June bugs. June bug is the adult stage of the grub worm, and when you start seeing the June bugs, this is your signal to get those beneficial nematodes out there within a couple of weeks, because when you start seeing a bunch of June bugs, you're going to have a bunch of eggs laid, and 2-3 weeks later, you're going to have a bunch of grub worms hatching out, and it's those really young grub worms, what we call the first and second larval instars, that do all the damage to your grass. But what so often happens is, we make one application, then we get busy. Maybe we do get to leave town on a little vacation, or we're just not out in the yard or whatever. We don't see that later flight of June bugs come through. We get more grubs and we get lots of damage. So to be on the safe side, again, we usually recommend one application in about March and a second one in May or June. Occasionally, in a weird year, like if we have a very dry late spring and summer, and then late summer we start getting pretty good rains, sometimes that will trigger a late flight of June bugs, and we'll recommend making an application even as late as September. The good thing about beneficial nematodes is you're not just killing grub worms, you're killing fleas, you're killing fire ants, you're killing the larval state of a lot of different troublemakers. So yes, the long answer to a short question. Sometimes more than one application is a good idea.
Yeah, I gotta get on that. Okay, well, I'll do my compost, and then next spring I will put out the nematodes. Again in the summer.
Very good. Well, I'm glad you've still got plenty of good grass left. Keep an eye on it.
I love it.
I have not seen any brown patch at all this fall. I have people telling me they think they have brown patch, and every time I've looked, it's been like you. It's been just residual grub damage. But keep an eye on that beautiful grass that you've got, and if you see any of it start looks like it's going bad, reach down and pull on the individual blades the sign of brown patch, the blade will pull away from the runner, and it will be kind of yellow to brown, like it was just rotting where it was attached to the runner. So keep an eye out
for that. What do you do for the brown patch?
With that, you treat with cornmeal. But I'm not saying you have that. I just want you to maintain what grass you have and enjoy it. And I got to go to News Tower. Garrett's up next here on KTSA Radio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
Oh, but you know, don't dial right this minute. We'll probably save about the last 30 minutes of the show or so for more phone calls. But this is that time every week that we get to visit with the Dirt Doctor, which is such a pleasure. Good morning, Howard.
Good morning, everybody.
Sure enjoyed seeing you guys last week, and you had no more than driven out of the driveway, and I thought, oh, shoot, I forgot to give them a couple of samples of these Quasar sprayers that I was bragging about. So I'll do my best to get them in the mail to you this week, because they're truly the best sprayers that I've seen in 20, 30 years.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. I enjoyed being there. Shades of Green looks great. Looks better than ever. You got to be very proud of it.
We are very proud of it, and it's just fun to come to work in a place that's like working in a garden all day. And not that it's not a lot of work, as you well know, but it's nice to be doing something you enjoy, which we both enjoy. But sure enjoyed seeing y'all.
Yeah, it was a good trip. We enjoyed the visit, and as we told you, we were successful in winning the Harry the Hat tournament in Victoria, Texas.
Yeah, a big congratulations there. It, you know, golf is just it's a wonderful game if you play it right, and play it right means you have to concentrate on what you're doing. If your mind goes anywhere else, that little white ball will not go where you intended it to. So no matter what's going on in your life, you just have to put it aside if you're going to get out and play a good round of golf. And it sounds like you guys just had a lot of fun and played very well.
Yeah, we had a young fellow on our team that hit it 9 miles, and I hit a few good iron shots. Logan and the other teammates made some nice putts, so we had a fun time. It's for people don't know what we're talking about, we have a family golf tournament that's been going on now about close to 40 years, 30-something years in Victoria, so always on day after Thanksgiving.
That's great, and you play, what do they call it, a scramble where you're...
Yeah, everybody hits the same shot. Right.
Yeah, so if you got one guy that drives well, another guy that putts well, and a couple of people in the middle that can get the ball up on the green, then that's what it takes to win the tournament.
Yep, knock a few putts in. But anyway, we got some interesting fall color going on around here in Dallas. How's it looking down that way?
It's very spotty, but finally we've got some good color. But you know, some of the things that you would expect to color up are just real slow, but the red oaks are finally starting to have some good color. Mexican buckeye has you know, had a lot of good yellow color, but it's starting to lose the leaves. The cypress have that kind of reddish brown color that's kind of fun, just because you can look out along the area and you can tell where the creeks and where the rivers and things like that are, because their foliage color is so distinctive. And the other thing I guess Roberta and I were talking and commenting on as we were going out to lunch yesterday was some of the crepe myrtles are finally starting to have some nice color. So has your big ginkgo started coloring up, or where are you seeing the most color right now?
Funny that you ask. I just sent you a picture of it. I took this morning before it was totally light outside. I'll take a picture again once the light is there. But it's going to be at peak today. And a lot of my little ginkgos that are around in pots in various places that came from the big tree are all coloring up really well, too. So it's putting on a pretty good show. Last year, we didn't have any crepe myrtle color like you suggested. I'm seeing some of that around here, too. Huh. And we didn't have very good ginkgo color last year at all. But this year it's looking pretty good. And looks like the red oaks are trying to put on some color already, and going to put on a pretty good show as well as kind of the next wave. So for this part of the world, looks like we may have decent fall color.
Yeah, I just pulled that picture up, and that's just a magnificent tree. I love the ginkgos because what they represent historically, but they're also just a neat, you know, easy to grow tree if you have deep soil. I think that's the one thing people, well, I guess in Dallas as well as down here, if you're just sitting on a slab of limestone, they're probably not going to do real well. But if they've got some deep soil, they're cold hardy, they're somewhat drought tolerant. They didn't seem to mind the heat this summer, but I guess for a tree that's been around for several thousand years, it'd have to be pretty hardy to be on Earth as long as that species has.
Probably several million years. It's an interesting tree, and I've learned something pretty important about it from mine and helping other people plant the tree. I think because it is a prehistoric tree, you know, it was here when the dinosaurs were here,
right.
I think it requires a couple of things that we give it more than other trees do, and I've kind of proven that out with mine. I went overboard exposing the base of it. I exposed the root flare far more dramatically than I had ever recommended before. And I think that's a big deal. And then part of that same process, of course, is that's part of the organic program. And I think because it is such an ancient tree, that having that healthy, biologically active soil, that organic program, I think makes a heck of a difference. Because, as you know, and people ask me all the time, how do you get mine to grow more than 1 or 2 inches a year? There was a tree grower that called me last week and is coming over either today or sometime soon to see my tree.
Yeah.
And he's got several thousand ginkgos, and he asked me, he said, you know, they're not growing, they're about 2 inches a year, what can I do? And I said, well, I know the secret, so come on over and let me show you how it's done.
Well, I look forward to hearing about that, and if he's got them commercially available, I hope he'll send some of them down this way. You remind me, you'll be glad to know, like the day after you guys were down here, our good arborist friends at Ed or Tree Care, Ed called and said, looks like we've got several hours coming up in a couple of days. So they came out, and that oak tree we looked at that's having the problems, they did a dramatic exposure and cut out a bunch of roots that were, you know, girdling. And so we're going to watch this tree, and hopefully it will recover. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't buried real deeply. The major roots, you know, were pretty close up, but that mass of roots, and there were some girdling ones just below the surface. But boy, that air spade sure showed where they were, and we'll watch and see how they do. But it's so important on all trees. You were mentioning ancient trees. I enjoyed many years ago visiting up on the Olympic Peninsula in the Northwest and seeing how some of those ancient redwoods and things that how they rarely sprout and grow if the seed falls in the soil, but where it falls on top of what they call a nurse log, where it's already basically 4 feet up and it's putting its roots over and down into the soil, and that's about as dramatic it is in exposed root flares you can have anywhere. But that's another ancient tree that evolved its own way of making certain that it didn't get buried.
Yeah, that's cool. The your tree there at the nursery, I'm sure that one spot that I pointed out to you where the trunk was not only coming straight up, but it was even tilted back at the ground level, I bet they found a big girdling root right there.
You're exactly right. Exactly right.
It's amazing what it does, and it still gives people heartburn to have to deal with it. One of the things also about ginkgo that I ran into that relates to the same conversation, I designed a ginkgo into a property that's real close to my house here, consulted with them through the years, and I designed a ginkgo into this new area. They built a big new pool area and did all new landscaping, and I put one ginkgo in a special place, focal point. And I had to leave the day they called me. I had to leave town the day they called me and said the ginkgo was coming and they were going to plant it. So I told them over the phone, I said, there's a real good chance that the tree is 4-inch caliber ginkgo.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, big tree.
Burlap. I said, I'm almost sure you're going to find that that the tree is too deep in the ball. And uh-huh. I want you to take the burlap off, and before you plant it, pull the soil away from the trunk, and you're probably going to run into some adventitious roots. Get down to the flare so you can measure the true height of the ball before you even dig the hole and plant it. And they called me back later and said, boy, you were right. It was dramatic. Yeah. They uncovered 8 inches
wow.
of adventitious roots.
Uh-huh.
Coming out of the trunk of that tree before you got down to the flare. And they, of course, took all that off. I've got pictures of it. I don't know if I ever showed it to you or not, but it was dramatic. And here's the thing I'm pretty sure of. I think that's the case with all the ginkgos that are being sold out there. Is
uh-huh.
it that they're that way? That I had no idea that they produced adventitious roots so severely, and I think a lot of the growers are going under the misconception that it's okay to plant them deep because they'll send those things out. But I think that's one of the reasons why ginkgo in general grows so slowly.
I think you're exactly right, and I imagine that tree is a beautiful tree today that you're talking about.
Oh yeah, it's doing great. It makes all the difference in the world to get that corrected when you plant the tree. Now, you can correct it, as we always talk about, and we do all the time. You can correct it later on, but it's more powerful if you do it when the plant is when the tree is planted.
And a whole lot easier. We don't have any growers in this part of Texas that I know of that produce them. We have to get them out of California. We're only able to get a few a year, but I'll certainly make a note of when they come in to check that immediately. It's interesting. I think 100% of the crepe myrtles that get sold these days are too deep in the pots, but they're not so bad about putting out the adventitious roots. Normally, you can just brush or scrape the soil away from them, and you'll have some of the roots coming up from below, but the ginkgo sounds like it's just one of the worst out there for responding when it gets planted too deeply, and long term that causes such a problem. So I'm sure glad you brought it up. I will make a note here that when we start getting those things, which will probably be about February, to make that the first thing we check.
Well, I'll tell this guy that you're interested in him, and I'm sure he'll be interested in contacting you. Here's his growing operations over in East Texas, and I hope he'll listen. We'll see how it goes. For people planting other trees, the other ones that are in this chronic category of being too deep that I've seen besides crepe myrtles, I agree with that, are lacebark elms and Chinese mm-hmm. pistachios.
Yeah.
Neither one of those form adventitious roots too much either. Any tree will, but uh-huh. I've never seen a tree do it as significantly as the ginkgo does.
Wow. Well, it's an interesting tree, and that's an excellent and interesting observation because, it seems like back in the days that long prehistory when you and I were in school, they thought that ginkgos were actually represented in the fossil record only. They didn't even know there were any of them left on Earth. And in some monastery in Tibet or somewhere like that, they actually found some and brought them back into cultivation. And thank goodness there were a few still around.
Yeah, cool tree. We got another interesting thing going on here as well. Last week on my show, I got a call from a gardener saying that their oak trees were producing little red balls, and there were little red balls all over the ground. Are y'all getting any reports of that by any chance down there?
We see a lot of the cinnipid wasp galls on the leaves. I can't say that I've seen a lot on the ground, but is that what you're seeing, or is it something else?
Well, when they called and said that was happening, I said, sounds like galls to me, but I don't know why in the heck they're aborting and falling on the ground. I've never seen that.
I haven't either.
And I said, to anybody out there, I asked her if she could send me photographs of them. They, mm-hmm. She said they were about the size of berries on a holly, a Yopon holly. And she said, well, I'm not high tech. I'll see what I can do. And I talked about it a little bit more on the air. And in the next break, I had 15 emails of people sending me photographs of these little balls. In some cases, they were in cracks and driveways and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And the ground was solid red. So
wow.
I've never seen it. And one of the people listening to my show was an arborist buddy of mine. And he called me, Sandy Rose. He's the one that got me into the
reflower
stuff in the first place. He sent me an email. He said, Howard, yeah, it's galls. And he said they're primarily on post oaks, and that's what some of the other people had said. And I haven't talked to him yet about why it's such a curious deal that they were forming and then aborting and showing up on the ground. He also said, and I had noticed this too, that the various oaks are aborting small immature acorns this year worse than ever. So a couple of interesting things going on in that regard.
And that would make sense because we have very few post oaks down here. Get out in the country, especially if you go east, you start seeing, but golly, I could count on the fingers of one hand all the post oaks that I've ever seen in San Antonio proper. So, yeah, that would explain it. But it's mainly live oaks that we get the galls on all the time. And there's some times of year when, you know, the trash can up by our cash register is just full of little bags because when people have a problem, we always ask them put it in a Ziploc or something to bring it in case it's an insect or something that had spread. But, we just end up with the trash can full of leaves with the little galls still attached to them, but I've never seen or heard of the leaves shedding those galls before the leaves came down.
No.
But that's interesting.
I haven't seen that. Well, the live oak is when you have those galls like you're talking about, they're corky. They range in color from brown through grays into black.
Yeah.
And when you see them in abundance on a tree, it's a dead giveaway that the tree's in stress.
Yep.
Now, some of these other galls and these little red galls on the post oaks, it's probably related to stress, but I bet it's related to stress caused by weather, not by being too deep in the ground or something else like you see on the live oaks. And the other thing about live oak, when you see those galls real heavy in the canopy of the tree and you expose the flare, do the sick tree treatment and all, next season they won't be there anymore.
It's kind of like mistletoe. It's amazing the things that happen. Why that simple stress-causing problem that is so common in the landscape. But it's very interesting. Speaking of trees in general, we're amazed at how a lot of trees really seem to be recovering. There are trees out there, and we're talking to a couple of naturalists because we did a baseline study out at Roberta's Ranch earlier this week, and they were talking about how a number of trees that just seemed just literally almost dead from the summer weather we had. A lot of things were starting to put on foliage and starting to come back again that we were seriously concerned about. I tell people, you know, don't take anything for granted until we see how things come out next year. But it's these late summer, early fall rains, even though we haven't had enough rain to really put water back into the aquifers or the rivers and things, but I think it's just been a lifesaver for a lot of plants.
Yeah, I thought we got more than we got. Thursday, I guess, it seemed like we got half an inch to an inch, but the rain gauges around only showed about a third of an inch.
Yeah.
But it was a nice rain. There's nice soil moisture now.
Well, and it's good. And these rains, even the ones that were less than that, I always think when you're wetting the smooth bark on the trees, whether it's on the limbs or on the upper trunk and things like that, those trees are going to absorb a lot of moisture, you know, directly through that area. And sometimes it just kind of helps hold them over until we get that good soaking rain, which we've had a couple, but golly, we hate to say it, but we're ready for a flood down here. You know, the flow is still so low and the creeks and rivers and the aquifers are seriously depleted, not at record low levels, but a lot of the lakes, Canyon Lake up just north of San Antonio, is the lowest it's been since it was built, and we're ready for a small flood, not a major one. But one other thing I wanted to be sure we talked about today is got the emails, I guess, from Doug reminding folks that to contribute to TORC, and this is that time of year where a lot of us who engage in philanthropic giving remember to send support to the organizations they care about, and of course TORC is certainly one of the ones that I support. And just wanted you to talk for a minute about what TORC is.
Well, the Texas Organic Research Center is a nonprofit that we set up that had primarily a mission to accumulate and make available research and data, both scientific research and anecdotal stuff, about the negatives of things we don't recommend and the positives, the things that are part of the organic program that we do recommend and all. And so that's on the website, TORC. It's TexasOrganicResearchCenter.org. Some of that same stuff is on DirtDoctor.com, but it's more concentrated and everything on the TORC site. So that's the main thing. And then we've done a lot of the research and my type research, mostly anecdotal, but it's also part of the TORC mission statement. And the latest thing we've been doing, we're working with some nonprofits. TORC is helping nonprofits. One of them got a little publicity here this past week. It's called Men of Nehemiah, and it's a nonprofit that takes in primarily military people, but not just military people. It turns it into a military kind of situation, but it's primarily drug addicts and people and alcoholics, and come in, and we've helped them set up gardens, and we've taught them how to do gardening down at their place down in South Dallas, and we're about to start the second one of those nonprofits, and that's all a part of what TORC's doing as well. They're having a lot of fun. They're really enjoying growing gardens for the first time in their lives.
And that's so important. This world is filled with so many stress, and apparently veterans coming back from some of the horrible things that have been going on around the world. We've had a very successful program called the Wounded Warriors Project that one of our customers
was
instrumental in.
That too.
Helping set up. But anyway, it's just coming. December's the time a lot of people who engage in philanthropic giving, send a check here and there, and I just always like to talk about it because TORC is one of the organizations that I certainly support as best I can, and just want to be sure that listeners that so enjoy. Still, this little segment we do is probably gets more comment than anything else we do. And so we just want the listeners to know that there is something they can support out there that's just a really great thing.
I appreciate that. One more quick thing, though. I've kind of misspoke a little bit. Wounded Warriors is not the one we support. And you might want to look into this a little bit. One thing we look at is how much money that comes in actually goes, to benefit instead of paying the executives, and the one we found that's better from that veteran standpoint and first responders and all that is Tunnels to Towers. So you might look at that and everybody.
Absolutely. Well, and they weather forced them to postpone it, but you're well aware of our friend Diane Baines down here, and her husband was a man who was not singly, but the driving force behind getting our Vietnam Veterans Memorial done here in San Antonio. We're really proud of the people that have been able to do. But back to one thing that I wanted to ask about in the garden or just in the environment, we are seeing the biggest concentration of flies. And just the old house fly, not some of the, better flies around, but we're seeing more flies than I ever remember seeing at this time of year. Have you heard any of that from your listeners?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, last week somebody called in and said they had flies as a problem, and they said they had big, colorful eyes. And my first reaction to that was, well, it sounds like tachinid flies, which are beneficial.
Yeah. Right.
And he sent me some pictures, and they kind of look like an unusual kind of thinnish tachinid fly. So you got to be a little bit careful about that, I guess. If you have flies and you can shoo them outside, if they're tachinids, man, they're very beneficial. They lay eggs on the back of caterpillars and, and do a lot of control. Now, why they'd be showing up all of a sudden in heavy amounts now and even in the house, I don't know. But we're looking into that as well. So we'll stay in touch on that.
Well, and we're not, that's not what we're seeing. The tachinid flies, you know, those, and I guess I need to go pull out the Texas Bug Book and leave it up front for our folks to be able to show people the difference in flies. We're seeing a lot of just common nuisance house flies.
House flies?
Yeah, and it's just weird that here we're into December, and that's something that sometimes July or August we see when it gets dry, and then we get a little bit of rain. But I was just curious, you know, what you were seeing. And like you say, just people need to be sure before they start, you know, trying to eliminate them. But we were trying to sit outside and do some riding, and just you're literally with the fly swatter in one hand and have them just buzzing around you. But it...
One thing that really does work, if people haven't tried it, and we've got photographs of a restaurant that uses the technique on the website, and then I think even in the Texas Bug Book, and that is put water in a clear plastic bag, hang it in the area. It's amazing how well it works.
And it's another one of those things, you know, like the old Red Skelton thing. I just do them. I don't explain them. I'm not sure why it works, but it sure is an interesting thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, well, it's there's an interesting range of topics that we were just talking about. I was talking earlier, you probably heard me, about, you know, increasing winter hardiness, and garret juice is one of those things that you can just add a little bit extra liquid seaweed to that I think will do the same thing. But maybe next week we'll talk about some of the techniques we both recommend to make plants a little bit hardier, because more cold hardy. So it's going to be a warm week down here. I think we're looking at temperatures in the 70s for the next few days, and it's going to be make it a great time to get out and get some gardening done, which we're really looking forward to. But anyway, it's always such a pleasure to get a little visit in with you. I'll try to get these Quasar sprayers off to you and see if you're as impressed with them as we are. And once again, just thanks for making us a part of your trip when you were down this way last week.
Well, thanks to you guys, and everybody enjoy the weather and enjoy those healthy gardens. We'll see everybody next week.
We'll look forward to it, Howard. Thank you so much. Mr. Howard Garrett is the Dirt Doctor. His website, dirtdoctor.com, best on the internet for gardening questions. And, of course, he's up in the Metroplex, up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. But what you're going to find on dirtdoctor.com is very much applicable to us here in South Texas. And, again, I think you'll find it to be a wonderful resource. Something else we may talk about next week is getting a little bit harder to find some of the great books that he and Malcolm together have produced. So I think the website's going to be even more important in the future for identifying things. And I've got to make a note here to talk to him about something else too next week. But anyway, Howard Garrett is the Dirt Doctor, and if you've not experienced or explored DirtDoctor.com, do so. We've got time for a few more phone calls. You know the number, 210-599-5555. Jimmy, let's run some commercials and get back and hopefully take a few more calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening, back to the phone lines. Tana and John are waiting to talk. Tana's up first. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, sir.
Good morning.
I've got one of those gardening 101 type questions.
All right.
I'm at the point now where I cannot dig my own holes. So I will be asking someone else to do it, and of course, put the whatever it is I want in the hole. So especially after listening to y'all's conversation this morning, I've opted for the ginkgo tree.
Uh-huh.
And y'all were talking about the adventitious roots.
Right.
Now, how do I explain to her how to determine the difference between an adventitious and the actual root flare?
Okay, that's a great question. The adventitious roots will be like just a network of very fine fibrous roots. It's just almost like an old loofah sponge. Just the individual roots are very tiny, but there's just a huge mass of them there. The actual root flare is going to be the big major roots that are probably, maybe a fourth to a third the diameter of the trunk. The roots that look like they're really going to support the trunk of the tree, whereas the rest of this is just kind of a dense mass of very fine roots, is what we refer to as the adventitious roots.
Okay, good. Well, in the past, I had just gone by what looked proper to me and to the larger roots, and I just wanted a better way of explaining it.
Well, as an experienced gardener, you know what you're looking at. The other thing that I love to do around the nursery here, because we have such beautiful root flares on our cypress trees and even on the bigger sycamores that we have, is to take people out and just show them what they're looking for. So anybody doesn't know what a root flare is, boy, come by here and we can show you some magnificent ones. And I know when we do our gift markets over in the Atlanta area, golly, some of those old crepe myrtles over there, they've got root flares on them where the trunk of the crepe myrtle may be 10 or 12 inches wide, but the root flare is 2 feet wide. And there's some wonderful examples around. So, I'm glad you're helping your friends understand that. But there's some good examples around that they can certainly come and see.
And I know what you're talking about when you say that some of the growers, they just put layer after layer after layer. Mm-hmm. Because the last time I got a young tree, it was that way, and I had to go down. There was hardly any soil left by the time I got to the actual root flare.
Well, and what caused that is that the growers, I think, made a huge mistake a number of years ago, because a lot of years ago they paid people hourly wages, like, so many businesses do. And they went from doing that to paying per piece. So their workers got paid to see how quickly they could repot things. And when you just stick a plant in a pot and dump soil around it, you can do four times as many. And so this was a great money-making opportunity for the labor force to lower the quality but speed up the production. And that's why all of a sudden, instead of doing it right, they just stick in the pot, pile soil around it, and move on to the next one. So, it's a problem, but it's something we just need to be aware of. One thing I was going to tell you, it certainly won't help you with planting a ginkgo tree, but you might want to look at there's something called a MAX, M-A-X. I think it's just with one X, but the MAX bit. And it's a not an auger. It's a heavy-duty chunk of metal that you put on the end of a little power drill. And if you were planting tomato plants or if you were planting ground cover or things like that, I was using it to plant potatoes.
I'm sorry, I've got another call, a parting call coming in. I've got to get it.
You get it, and we'll talk again soon. But for the benefit of everybody listening, if you're looking for something that will really help speed up planting, if you've got, say, 200 ground cover plants or something to plant, check out the MAX bit, because you put it on your electric drill. And I know I was using it to plant potatoes one day, and I don't know how many I drilled, maybe 50 or 60 holes to just go along, drop the pieces of potatoes in, but probably took less than 5 to 10 minutes to do that. But anyway, another great Christmas present there. We've got to get one more commercial break in here, Jimmy, so let's get that done. We'll come back and talk to John.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening, and I believe John is next in line. Good morning, John.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
My question is, I don't know if it's simple or not, but there's this, I got a lot of stickers all over my yard.
Yes,
like
sir.
About 2 acres. 2 acres of my yard is covered in stickers. There's nothing I can do. I haven't been able to get rid of them. What can I do to get rid of them?
Well, the sticker burr plants that produced all those stickers are dead now. There's nothing you can do. You wouldn't accomplish anything by trying to kill the plants that produce the stickers because they die out in the winter anyway. The problem is that they have made lots and lots of stickers, which are, you know, the seeds for next year's crop. They're tough to control, and the chemical guys out there will tell you, you've got to put out pre-emergent herbicides. But the problem is the blasted sticker burrs, they can germinate and grow anywhere from about, March or April all the way up until September. So if you were going to go with chemical pre-emergence, you'd have to put them out 5 or 6 times, which would be prohibitively expensive and probably not all that effective. In some areas, a controlled burn is what some people have used to get rid of them on acreage like that, or at least to reduce them a great deal. I personally had an area in my yard. It's a pretty good size area. We should use it for a croquet court. It's probably 20 feet wide, maybe 40, 50 feet long. The stickers were so thick the dogs wouldn't even try to walk into the area. And I put a layer of compost, between a quarter and half an inch of compost over it. Compost has a lot of humic acids, fulvic acids, things like that. And I did it in either October or November, probably November. And the next spring in that whole area, I think I pulled like 3 or 4 sticker burr plants in the whole area. So the compost almost totally eliminated them. Now, you can't do that on 2 acres. That's just, prohibitive to think about doing that. But in area of your yard that your family uses or that your dogs use or whatever else, I would highly recommend it for a number of reasons. Compost is just almost like magic in helping things recover, from the bad, bad summer that we had. But on your acreage, your best, as they say, your best defense would be a good offense. And again, I'll go with, personal experience. I have a field that I used to grow Sudan hay in back when I had the time to do that. And that got so many stickers that, you couldn't even walk into it during dove season. But I planted, overseeded with just a native grass blend, and Mother Nature cooperated. We got some rain at the last time, and today there's hardly a sticker burr in that whole pasture. That the native grasses, given the opportunity, because I kept the cattle off of it for a little while, but the native grasses almost totally choked them out, and that's probably going to be the best thing you can do in those two areas, if it's an area that you can overseed, if it's something to be sure that it's not going to get overgrazed until the native grass gets established. The sticker burrs are just a weak grass, so the weakest grass out there, but anywhere you've got bare soil, that's what Mother Nature's going to send in, because they grow so quickly and reproduce so proficiently. But around your yard, I'd sure recommend the compost. But if there's any way you can in the outer areas, get a good native grass blend from Douglas King Seed or somewhere like that. And given a season or two to grow, you'd be amazed how many sticker burrs they will choke out.
I guess his phone dropped.
I guess your phone dropped, George. I hope you got that information, and I hope you have as much luck with it in both of those situations as I have. Time for one more call if anybody wants to dial that 210-599-5555 number. We'll go over just, a couple of things that we were talking about earlier in the show. Very important this time of year. To get your fall fertilizer out. Grass, tree, shrubs, things like that. Feeding now will increase the cold hardiness as well as get your plants ready for a good strong burst of growth next spring. Don't wait till spring to do your spring fertilizing. By then, it's going to take a while for the fertilizer microbes in the soil to really properly process it. So very important that you feed this time of year. I also think it's a great time for many reasons to put that thin layer of compost over the yard. By then, I mean a quarter to half an inch. I don't know of anything that will do more to help your yard recover from the heat and the drought damage, grub worm damage, all the things that we saw this summer. But putting some compost out, if you've got a big area, by all means, buy it in bulk. Try to avoid biosolids compost, but just a good manure-based compost is a wonderful thing to put over any area that you're really wanting to get your grass restored. Great thing to do for your vegetable garden or your herb garden, for that matter, as well. But anything that you really want to increase the winter hardiness on, spray with something that contains liquid seaweed. Either make your own spray or get some Garrett juice and add some extra seaweed to it. But spraying every couple of weeks can add several degrees of cold hardiness to those plants, but you can't put it off till the night before it freezes. It's something you need to be doing right now. As far as planting, golly, the cyclamen are so beautiful this year, especially some of the new bicolor types, but the cyclamen are just beautiful. And if you're looking for something to plant in the shadier areas of your yard that'll give you color all winter long, cyclamen are one of your very best bets for the shade. There's a little plant called the German primrose is another real pretty one, and the ornamental kale and cabbage will do very well in the shade and will be very colorful. The cooler the weather gets, the more those deep colors come out. Sunnier areas, if you want something that's going to bloom all winter, your pansies, and they're little ones look kind of like miniature pansies. We call Johnny Jump Up. Some people just call them violas. To me, a viola is just a smaller pansy, but still a little bit bigger than a Johnny Jump Up. But those things will bloom literally every day of the winter and very, very cold hardy as well. Other great things to plant, snapdragons, dianthus, petunias, stock. Those are all things that bloom in the fall, grow through the winter, and then bloom again in the spring. Most of them are still in full bloom now because we really haven't had a heavy frost or a killing freeze. But there's just no reason to have a drab yard. There are so many pretty colorful things that you can be planting out there at this time of the year. One other thing I would suggest is if you have put houseplants out for the warm months of the year, move them to a shady area. They're going to go through a little bit of shock when you bring them back inside, mainly because of the decrease in light. And who knows what the weather's going to do for the next few weeks, but it's a whole lot better to let them get acclimated, to drop whatever leaves they're going to while they're still outside. So the things you've had in a sunny area but need to come in, move them to a shadier area. Watch your watering carefully. Things aren't needing nearly as much water as they were while we were so hot and dry, but be sure you water thoroughly when you water. Let that soil get dry and knuckle deep and water thoroughly again. But giving those houseplants a chance to adapt a little bit to the conditions they're going to have inside be a great thing to do over the next few weeks. And while you're at it, you know, note those places in your home, those really sunny windows where you can move things when you bring them in, especially things that are highlight, like the different ficus, the fiddly figs, the rubber plants, ficus benjaminas. Also, your narrow leaf dracaenas like Dracaena marginata, those are all plants that really need a lot of light. So they're going to need a bright window. Best to go ahead and get those areas figured out so that when we all get surprised when the weatherman at the last minute predicts a hard freeze, you kind of have in mind where you're going to bring things in. If you have any problem with snails or slugs or pill bugs or things like that, you might want to put a little bit of Slug-O Plus in those pots now just so you can kill the pests before you bring them inside. If you have an issue with ants in the pots of living plants, very dilute orange oil is what you want to mix up and pour through. Make it dilute so that you kill the ants without actually harming your plants. Other things to tell you about the vegetable garden, you know, like I say, things that are planted from seed, it's going to take them a few weeks to really harden off. So if you plant your lettuce, if you plant your spinach, if you plant carrots and, you know, radishes, things like that, just be aware for those first couple of weeks, you may need to cover them if we have frost or pretty severe weather predicted. But great time to plant all your leafy vegetables, the chard, the cabbage, the kale, Lettuce, spinach, bok choy, all those things, good time to get those planted in the garden. Good time still to be planting broccoli and cauliflower and cabbage. Brussels sprouts, maybe getting a little bit late because it takes them a longer time to produce than it does some of the others, but those and then all the root crops. those can certainly go in right now as well. Lots for you to do. I hope one of the things that you do is join me again tomorrow morning where we talk plants from 8 till 11 and leave that dial where it is right now for Martin Bomba and your home projects. That's up next here on KTSA Radio.